Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
In 1987, the Oprah Show had only been on the air for 5 months. Trouble was brewing in the Deep South, in a county where no black person had lived in 75 years. For the first time, Oprah left her studio and headed straight into the eye of the storm.
We bring you today to Forsyth County, Georgia, just 30 miles north of Atlanta, which in the past few weeks has gained the reputation of being a hotbed of racism. Here are just some of the images of Forsyth County in past weeks that were broadcast around the globe.
There's no niggers here. Why should they even come, you know? They asked for it. They got it. So why'd they come back, you know?
Nigger, go home! Nigger, go home! Nigger, go home!
No King Holiday! No King Holiday!
It's hard to believe that this show aired nearly 30 years ago. Oprah's show in Forsyth was causing an uproar. As protests were going on outside, tempers were heating up inside, too.
Somebody tell me, where did the people who come from who were shouting, nigger, go home? They came from where?
Yes, ma'am. They came from, my name's Frank Shirley. I'm the head of the committee to keep Forsyth and Dawson County white.
Let him speak. Please let him speak. He has the right to speak.
Okay, the news media is covered up. There were thousands of white people that came out to join our white people's protest. This is the largest white people's protest against communism and race mixing in the last 30 years. The news media has deliberately covered up the nature of the Brotherhood marchers, many of whom are outright communists and homosexuals, and our organization was the only one that dared take a stand against them. They brought in thousands.
You're not just anti-black, you're also anti-gay, too.
I'm opposed to communism, race mixing, and low morals, and homosexuals are of low morals, in my opinion.
You don't believe that people of other races have the right to live here?
They have the right to live wherever they want to, but we have the right to choose if we want a white community also. That's why we moved here.
You believe? That's what you believe. Excuse me. Why is it that there are people in this county, obviously, who are afraid of black people? What is it you are afraid black people are going to do? I mean, that's what I'd like to know.
I'm afraid of them coming to Forsyth County. I lived in Atlanta. I was born in Atlanta. And in 1963, the first blacks were bused to West Fulton High School. And I go down there now, and I see my neighborhood and my community, which was a nice community, a nice neighborhood, and now it's nothing but a rat-infested slum area because they don't care.
Right.
They don't care. Thank you.
No, wait, stand up. What's that? You know. Do you mean they, us, the entire black race? The entire black race?
Blacks, and you have niggers.
What's the difference between a black person and a nigger to you?
I've talked to black people. Black people, they don't want to come up here. They don't want to cause any trouble. That's a black person. A nigger wants to come up here and cause trouble all the time. That's the difference.
Well, yes. I have something to say. I'm very upset about what's going on. I don't think that Forsyth County has been portrayed right. It's not only by what's outside right now, but I just really hate to think that it's going to take someone either black or white getting hurt or losing their lives before people can sit down and talk this out. It is a time for change. There's nothing we can do about it. Everybody, there's one God. And I just hate to think that someone is going to get hurt before the people get some sense about them and talk about this and get it like it's supposed to be.
How is it supposed to be?
Black and white together in Forsyth County. There's no other way.
Oprah says she and her producers knew it was dangerous to go down there, but they were smart enough to know to leave town before the sun went down.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's day, Friday, May 19th, 2017. So I have been told this is our eighth study session on the autobiography of the late Mrs. Coretta Scott King, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, as told to Reverend Dr. Barbara Reynolds. We are picking up on Chapter 19, An Injustice Anywhere is a Threat to Justice Everywhere. Picking up Chapter 19, where last week she was talking about Mrs. King. She was talking about some of the activist work that she participated in after her husband's assassination. She'll continue in that vein this week, addressing her work in South Africa and the audio clip that you heard at the beginning, the incident that happened in Forsyth County, Georgia, which should be very familiar to Kyle's listeners. We talked about that situation repeatedly. Most recently, I think, when we had Patrick Phillips on the program to discuss his book, Blood at the Root, which was all centered around the King holiday. I think the second year that the King holiday was in existence as a national holiday, and they were going to have the march in Forsyth County, and the whites came out and booed and yelled. They had white children and everything and called them niggers, everything. And then they went back. Coretta Scott King, she was with them the second time that they went back, and she's going to talk about that this week. Without further ado, we will go ahead and get started. Context of white supremacy, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, the autobiography of Mrs. Coretta Scott King. Audio segment number one.
Following the success in the Montgomery bus boycott back in 1955, other boycotts had spread to southern cities in the United States, such as Birmingham and Tallahassee. Much to our surprise, however, in 1957, Blacks also launched a bus boycott in Johannesburg, South Africa, in an effort to call attention to their plight and show solidarity with our movement. That protest shook us up. It made us focus our attention on how brutally the white Afrikaners in South Africa were treating those classified as black and colored. We recoiled at the news of the 1960 Sharpeville massacre, in which Afrikaner police shot 200 blacks, killing 69 of them, during a peaceful protest against unfair pass laws, which were designed to keep the black and colored populations segregated. The greatest apartheid-era catastrophe, however, and the one that galvanized the world's attention and fueled the movement to boycott companies supporting apartheid, was the one that happened on June 16, 1976, the year before Carter sent me to the United Nations. That June, students were protesting the government closure of many of their schools and resisting an official policy that required them to be taught only in Afrikaans, the language of the Afrikaners, which most blacks did not speak. As part of this protest, the students organized a march in Soweto. More than 20,000 students turned up to the march, followed closely by the police. Tensions mounted between the blacks and the police. Angered by their plight, the children taunted the police, who responded with tear gas and then live ammunition. They shot round after round. Children of all ages were gunned down, 360 children in all. Reports showed haunting images of small children, little children like Hector Peterson, swatted down and killed without thought, like they had no more worth than pesky mosquitoes. I made ending apartheid a priority of the King Center and a personal one as well. In the mid-1980s, the resistance to apartheid was moving so slowly in the United States that it had to be embraced by the African-American community to gain momentum. In 1982, when I addressed the World Council of Churches in Vancouver, I had met with Desmond Tutu, who was then Secretary General of the South African Council of Churches, and with Reverend Alan Bosack, a well-respected anti-apartheid activist and president of the World Alliance of Reformed Churches. The two men had wanted to work with me, and I'd wanted to visit South Africa, and I understood that their churches could provide the right kind of sponsorship for my trip. Having a host for a visit was very important, because visiting South Africa was a delicate undertaking, laden with political complexities. Tensions between the apartheid regime and the majority black populace were high. In 1983, when Reverend Bosack spoke at the King Center to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the March on Washington, I renewed the subject of a trip to Soweto and to Cape Town. I will be attending the United Nations International Women's Conference in Nairobi, Kenya in 1985, I told him. I really would like to come to South Africa on my way. Could either you or Bishop Tutu host the visit? But strangely enough, neither Reverend Bosack nor Bishop Tutu responded to that request. In 1985, while I was attending the conference in Nairobi, some of the other attendees there, insiders in the Free South Africa movement, briefed me on the reasons for the cold shoulder concerning my proposed trip to South Africa. They told me that Randall Robinson, a very talented man and head of TransAfrica and one of the leaders of the Free South Africa movement, and Jesse Jackson, had been working to turn some of the black South Africans against me because they were working in the region and considered me to be infringing on their turf. At the time, I didn't think much about what I'd been told. But the next time I saw Reverend Bosack in Atlanta, he did not seem eager for me to come to South Africa. In fact, it seemed that he was deliberately delaying me. In a conversation with Andy Young, Reverend Bosack intimated that it might take 6 months or more to plan my trip. Baloney. That was the response from Stoney Cooks, Andy's top aide, when I told him what Reverend Bosack had said. You need to go right now, Stoney added. It's not like you don't know anything about South Africa. You held conferences on it, given speeches, written numerous columns on sanctions and apartheid. You need to go now. He was right, of course. But one cannot just up and go to South Africa without some of the main leaders in Soweto, such as Bosack and Desmond Tutu, hosting you. So, since they did not honor my request, I did not go at that time. Still, I could not drop the issue. I was troubled in my spirit by the unrest in South Africa. The very instability that was complicating my plans was drawing me to travel there, because I understood the power of strategic nonviolent opposition. One of my board members, who was agonizing over the same situation, asked, "Of all the things we're doing with nonviolence and teaching nonviolence, why can't we help South Africa?" And I said, "I think we can." I appointed a committee to come up with a plan, a program, and a way by which we could address the problem of apartheid. Perhaps a visit to South Africa would be helpful. Therefore, we proceeded to plan a trip, and I selected a group of people whom I thought represented different segments of the community. Reverend Barbara Skinner, a member of the Board of Advisors, who could help us on our fact-finding mission with women. Christine King Ferris for education. Carol Hoover and Bob Brown, both King Center board members and business persons. Bernard Lafayette to help advise on nonviolence training. And my son, Martin III, on youth outreach. In the end, we had about 13 people ready for the trip. One of them was Ronald Quincy, a State Department representative who had been a White House fellow and who later became executive director of the King Center. As we prepared, we consulted Andy Young on the culture and the correct protocol. "What you're trying to do is very difficult," he told us. "It's almost impossible. If you go, you have to talk to everybody. You have to talk to the enemy, President Botha. And when you talk to one set of people, other groups will get angry with you. They won't speak to you. But I think if anybody can be successful in doing it, you can." We also followed protocol and sought information and a briefing from the U.S. State Department. I let President Reagan know my plans so that when I returned, I could tell him what I'd done and try to get his support. We hoped to get him to come around and support a strong anti-apartheid act. I also called on Vice President Bush and Secretary of State George Shultz, telling them about our plans and asking for their advice and support. Secretary Shultz encouraged the trip, as well as my plans to try to see Nelson Mandela. "If I went over there and didn't try to see Mandela," he told me, "people would ask why I hadn't at least made an attempt." He also said that the only way I could arrange that meeting was through then-President P.W. Botha. He added, You and Dr. King stood for the philosophy of nonviolence and forgiveness. It would be a powerful thing if you could get permission to see Nelson and Winnie, and the three of you could be together. Can you imagine what that photograph would look like going around the world? It would send a powerful message of unity and support for the Mandelas. Well, I told him, we will try. So, through the King Center, we made an appointment with President Botha. At our meeting, I planned to bring up the question of visiting Mandela. The State Department assigned a person to go with us, which was very helpful. In those days, many South Africans were deeply suspicious of visitors, and my people were very upset about my not taking security. I also obtained a briefing from some of the U.S. lobbyists for the African National Congress, ANC, the lead party against apartheid, as well as from some ANC activists in South Africa, such as Oliver Tambo. When I spoke to them about nonviolence, I put it in this way. You know that economic sanctions are a form of nonviolence. You do not have to pick up a gun. Withdrawing your patronage is a weapon Martin used all the time. We didn't cooperate with people who discriminated against us and who were doing evil and unjust things to us. If we can get sanctions against South Africa going in the United States, this would be a nonviolent tool. I think such explanations were helpful in showing an alternate vision. Many people at that time did not see sanctions in this light. If the goal is ending a violent and unjust regime, do you treat your enemies as persons beyond human understanding, as unworthy of any interaction? Do you designate them hopeless cases and slam the door? I see it as a crucial article of faith in nonviolence that even the most violent of adversaries can be approached in a true spirit of reconciliation. When he first organized his nonviolent resistance campaigns, Mahatma Gandhi held frequent meetings with Boer General Jan Christian Smuts, his principal adversary in South Africa. Gandhi once said, "In a nonviolent conflict, there is no rancor left behind, and in the end, the enemies are converted into friends." That was my experience in South Africa with General Smuts. In 1985, at a time of national and international boycotts and protests against companies that invested in South Africa and calls for sanctions against South Africa, I was arrested along with Martin III and Bernice in a protest against apartheid at the South African Embassy in Washington, D.C. At last, in 1986, it was time to go to South Africa. I had accepted an invitation to the enthronement of Bishop Tutu, who was about to become Archbishop of Cape Town, South Africa's legislative capital, located in the southernmost part of the country. Accompanied by my board members, I flew into Harare, Zimbabwe on September 2, 1986, to attend the Conference of Non-Aligned Nations. While there, I met with President Kenneth Kaunda of Zambia, President Ket K.J. Masiri of Botswana, President Samora Machel of Mozambique, Prime Minister Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, Oliver Tambo, past president of the Non-Aligned Nations Conference, and my good friend Indira Gandhi, all of whom were members of the Non-Aligned Nations. All agreed that whatever sanctions were imposed against South Africa, the United States must help provide economic aid to keep the country and the region from collapsing. From there, I went to Johannesburg, South Africa, where I attended a dinner for Leon Sullivan, a Baptist preacher from Philadelphia, who was a major player in helping businesses in South Africa work out fair labor practices. I also met with several South African business people and civil and community leaders across racial lines. We also held international prayer breakfasts in Johannesburg and Cape Town. When we arrived in Cape Town, however, we found that there was trouble brewing with regard to our arrival. Carl Ware, a top executive for Coca-Cola who had worked extensively in South Africa, called me. He said the word on the street was that Winnie Mandela and Reverend Alan Bozak were not going to meet with me because I had an appointment to see President Botha. I was also told that some black activists thought my meeting with Botha was aiding and abetting his murder and repression of black South Africans, a very serious and dangerous misconception. Several sources also told me that Randall Robinson had called ahead and told people that I had been ill-advised, didn't know what I was doing, and was in South Africa to stir up stuff. Bishop John Walker, the dean of the Washington National Cathedral, also in Cape Town for Tutu's enthronement, was so worried about what he had heard that he knocked on my door at my hotel one night to share his concern for me. "I am so upset, because we don't want your image tarnished by the negative things being said," he told me. He went on to say that the statements in question seemed to be coming from Randall Robinson and Jesse Jackson. Randall had been working with TransAfrica on the problem of apartheid for a long time, but I had also been working on this problem for a long time. I'd even tried to work with Randall. Whenever he called a coalition together, I was there. I was at all the press conferences, I was at all the marches, I made statements, I was very actively involved. I'd even asked him for a briefing before I left for South Africa, but his strategy appeared to be to try to turn the fellows against me and to question the potential of nonviolent protest in South Africa. In any event, at a ceremony following his enthronement, Bishop Tutu graciously introduced me, the only person he introduced at the service. He also gave our delegation front-row seats across from his family. I had 8 or 9 people with me: Martin III, Christine, Carol Hoover, Ebenezer Church pastor Joseph Roberts, and several others. We have beautiful memories of that service. When I finally had a chance to talk with Desmond, I said, "I want to understand what the problem is. I was trying to meet with President Botha because I wanted to see Nelson Mandela, and I was told that meeting with you and the president was the only way I could do it." Desmond told me, "You see, there's nothing wrong with your meeting with our national president. I have met with him. But the problem is, because of killings that have taken place this year, some groups will take your meeting and use it against us. The enthronement is an act of reconciliation, and that's enough for them to focus on right now." What Desmond was telling me fit in with what I'd been told Randall and Jesse were saying. Finally, I called off my meeting with Botha. I also called off a meeting with Zulu Chief Mengosuthu Buthelezi, because I knew he was having problems with the ANC. The ANC had even said that if someone met with Buthelezi, he or she could not meet with the ANC. I took my board's advice and chose not to go ahead with the meetings. In the aftermath of my visit to South Africa, I had a meeting with Randall and some of my board members. It was one of the most insulting meetings I've ever attended. "Why did you go over there when you did not know what you were doing?" Randall demanded. He accused me of setting the Free South Africa movement back 10 years. He took aim at Bob Brown, a businessman on my board, who he claimed was dictating my actions in South Africa. Randall's accusations did not sit well with me. I remember defending myself firmly. Adding to my agitation was the fact that my board members did not defend me, not even Walter Fauntleroy, who was the first chair of the King Center Board and whom I helped get elected to Congress. They all just sat there and listened. I prayed about all these events. I realize now that I didn't do enough planning, but I also believe I was undermined. It was helpful to remember what Martin sometimes said when he preached a sermon entitled, "Going Forward by Going Backwards." In that sermon, he related the parable of Christ being left in the temple as a child. His parents journeyed for a whole day before they realized he'd been left. To recover this precious treasure, they had to go back. "Now," I told myself, "I have to go back before I can go forward. I have to build more direct ties with all the leaders of all the groups involved in South Africa." We took quite a beating in the press for the on-again, off-again meetings with Botha, but I was optimistic about the good news we'd spread as we traveled the length and breadth of that tormented but mesmerizing beautiful land. We built support there for economic sanctions, work stoppages, and an expanded Christmas boycott of downtown stores by blacks, all of which we presented as alternatives to guns. We also had a series of encouraging discussions with other white and black leaders who expressed a desire for greater international cooperation. And I was privileged enough to have met Nelson's wife, Winnie, who embraced me as a friend. Her words were a virtual torrent of pain as she shared with me how the apartheid system had stolen her life, how it felt to be denied the loving touch of her husband for 23 years, how she grieved over his forced labor in the Robben Island prison's rock quarry, which was damaging his lungs and his vision. Most of the time, Winnie spoke about her husband, but she also talked about herself and her children. She described the brutality and the isolation she felt after being beaten in prison and then banished and dumped in a house 230 miles away from her home in Soweto. The ramshackle structure had no running water or heat and only dirt floors. "I had to live that way for 8 years," she told me. "I am a trained social worker, but I was not allowed to be employed. The plan was to break me emotionally and financially. My husband was taken. My livelihood was taken. But through the help of friends, my two girls, Zanani and Zinzi, were sent off to private school in Swaziland, where they could get a good education." When Winnie talked about her children, her face relaxed. With pride, she told me about the marriage of her oldest daughter, Zanani, to Prince Tumbumuzi Dlamini of Swaziland, who was the son of Swazi King Zobuza II. But she also expressed her sadness over her inability to spend more time with her first grandchild, whom Nelson had named Zaziwe, which translates to hope. Winnie even shared with me some of the letters Nelson had written her. One read, "Had it not been for your visits, wonderful letters, and your love, I would have fallen apart many years ago." After that first meeting in Soweto, Winnie and I developed a very sisterly relationship. In 1992, we brought her to the Center for King Week and to participate in a panel following the Center's annual Salute to Greatness Awards dinner, and she served as Grand Marshal for our King Week parade and march. Later, in our private conversations during her visit, Winnie was very forthright, telling me directly that she came to the King Center to learn the language of peace. Still, though I had tremendous admiration for her, Winnie struggled with the central tenets of nonviolence. When her history is considered, I can understand this. Not only did she have to spend 27 years of her 38-year marriage without Nelson, but the apartheid government regularly detained her. As she worked to keep her husband's name and movement alive, she was tortured, subjected to house arrest, kept under surveillance, held in solitary confinement in Pretoria's Central Prison for a year and a half, and then banished to a remote town. Unfortunately, her reputation was damaged by charges of criminal behavior. It was also reported that in 1986 she endorsed a local practice of necklacing, during which suspected traitors were burned alive inside automobile tires soaked in gasoline. I don't know whether those charges are true, and naturally, I could never condone such acts of violence. I can, however, identify with her as a woman who is the wife of a man who led a revolution. In terms of what we have to do to keep things going when our husbands are no longer on the scene, when they are in jail or murdered, such women have so much in common. Winnie kept Nelson's memory and movement alive in the public eye. She held things together, and throughout her personal suffering, her jailing, banning, and torture, she reacted with so much strength and dignity. It is an awful thing to be banished and kept from your children. Who wouldn't be emotionally scarred by that ordeal? Of course, I'm also sympathetic to what Nelson went through. He is my hero. He led his nation into a democratic state and showed them that the ways you must behave once you become a nation versus being in a movement are very different. For him to go through all he did, come out of prison without being bitter and being able to show love to his enemies, I think he deserved whatever happiness he could get. And Winnie does too. So when the news came in 1996 that they were divorcing, I was sad but not necessarily surprised. To me, they were both good people who just could not make it. I think that in the years of separation, they grew apart. Winnie was so young when they married, and during Nelson's imprisonment, they didn't get to spend enough time together for their relationship to really bond them to one another. Nevertheless, when Nelson Mandela was finally released from prison on February 11, 1990, Winnie was by his side to rejoice. The whole world rejoiced. Shortly after Nelson was released, I received a call from Harry Belafonte. He told me that the ANC had asked him to ask me if I would coordinate and help raise funds for Nelson and Winnie Mandela's trip to America. Of course, I readily agreed. In fact, I had already invited Nelson and Winnie to the King's Center. I turned to Atlanta Mayor Maynard Jackson first and asked him to head the committee. He told me he was busy with his crime program but would support whatever I did. "Maynard," I countered, "you are the number one citizen in this city, and it would be appropriate for you to do this." He still couldn't take the lead, so I turned to Jesse Hill, my board chairman, and asked him to start raising the funds needed to bring in Nelson and his wife. In the meantime, I went off to South Africa and Zambia, where I worked to convince the ANC and others how important it was for the Mandelas to come to Atlanta. We also needed to raise a few $100,000, which was difficult. White people in Atlanta were not eager to raise funds for the ANC, which many associated with communism. So I went to Coca-Cola. I had a very good relationship with Donald Keogh, the president and chief operating officer. He told me that he found the cause appropriate and was happy to support us in any way he could, but he feared a backlash. He didn't think it wise to be publicly identified with the ANC, but he was happy to support us anonymously. Then suddenly the positive flow was interrupted. Randall Robinson apparently got wind of our plans. If Coca-Cola was involved, he said, his group was going to boycott the company. In other words, he was going to encourage the ANC not to allow the Mandelas to come to Atlanta. Soon we began to hear rumors that the Nelson Mandela event had been canceled. I first heard this from Harry Belafonte. He told me it was Randall's doing. And he said he told Randall, "You have to be out of your mind. We can't let this happen." Harry and I pushed back and managed to get the Mandela trip rescheduled. However, the back and forth had tired Nelson out, and some of his activities had to be curtailed. He was just overwhelmed, and our staff was unnecessarily overwhelmed. What was so disconcerting was that Randall Robinson had apparently urged this boycott. I heard that over and over from many trusted sources. In any event, a few months later, the Mandelas visited us at the King Center as part of their tour of Canada, the United States, and Europe. I, along with Mayor Jackson, Georgia Governor Joe Frank Harris, and the Reverend Joseph E. Lowery, then president of the SCLC, met the Mandelas' chartered jet when it landed at Atlanta's Hartsfield International Airport. We greeted them as they deplaned and walked down a red carpet to their waiting armored limousine. On the evening of June 27, 1990, about 50,000 people crammed into Georgia Tech's Bobby Dodd Stadium at historic Grant Field to hear Nelson speak. It was my pleasure to introduce him. In his speech, he linked the struggles of the poor and powerless around the world to the great freedom expressions of the American Civil Rights era under Dr. King, and he thanked the center's board and staff for their support in their just cause for freedom and opportunity in a one-person, one-vote democracy, South Africa. Before his address, he pulled up to our center, which he called the home of the civil rights movement, through a huge cadre of police cars blocking the street to allow the arrival of his entourage. He met privately with my family and staff and took part in ceremonies, during which we presented him with the King Center's International Freedom Award for 1990. He also laid a wreath at my husband's crypt. The reaction to this visit by Stephen Klein, the King Center's public relations person, summed up the event for many. "When he came through the door, everyone's jaw dropped," Klein said. "The center has been visited by heads of state, prime ministers, presidents, kings, and queens. But those visits didn't measure up to Mandela's. He was bigger than royalty. Mandela is somebody who actually earned the tremendous respect of people all over the world. He didn't inherit it." My daughter Bernice put it this way: "Outside of Jesus Christ and my parents, he is the one. He had such a very calm spirit, very dignified, a forgiving spirit. It was so comforting for me to see him." As I witnessed the enthusiastic outpouring of support from Americans of all races, creeds, and national origins who flocked to greet this world citizen everywhere he traveled, it felt like further proof that my husband was correct when he reminded his supporters that The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. In 1992, 2 years after Nelson's visit, the King Center became directly involved in South Africa in advance of that nation's first truly democratic national elections. The U.S. State Department gave the center a grant to create a curriculum and to train South African activists in the principles of Martin's nonviolent philosophy. We were told that our help was needed to counter what State Department officials feared would be riots and murders when those first free elections were held. It was widely assumed that the climate was ripe for violent confrontation on many fronts. In South Africa, 35 million black Africans had suffered excruciating violence under white rule, represented by 4.3 million white Afrikaners. We understood the possibility of violence both from people who were being forced to give up their power and from people who had been birthed in the crucible of violence and oppression. We were notified of horrific acts erupting between the various tribes, all of them arguing over the contents of the new constitution being drafted and the outcome of the first national election. When the call came for the center to participate in the training, we were ready. I had been to the region several times. We knew the terrain would be different, but we also knew that we shared experiences. As civil rights activists, we had all been on the firing lines of terrorism in America. From personal experience, many King Center staff knew what it felt like to be shot at or wrongly imprisoned, to have their homes firebombed, or to be denied the right to vote. We also had a few staff members who had worked in South Africa. Our three senior trainers, Harold Sims, Dr. Bernard Lafayette, and Charles Alphen Sr., incorporated bits of language that reflected the South African principle of Ubuntu, which conveys a fervent belief in respect for human life, into the King Center teaching materials, including into the center's six principles of nonviolence. In South Africa, one great advantage in teaching the principles and the steps was, by good fortune, already having a supportive institution in place there. In the mid-1980s, Reverend Joseph Tshwane, a South African student at the Union Theological Seminary in Richmond, Virginia, had come to the center to study Martin's principles of nonviolence, as scholars and students from all over the world continue to do. He was a charismatic figure and a recording artist affiliated with a Presbyterian church. He had asked us for permission to establish the King Luthuli Transformation Center in Johannesburg. After consulting with local leaders in South Africa, including Bishop Desmond Tutu, the King Center helped Tshwane found the King Luthuli Transformation Center in 1987. Tshwane understood how to integrate Kingian principles with the Ubuntu respect for life. In 1992, when the peace training preparations for the 1994 election began, the pre-existence of the Transformation Center helped us avoid the appearance of imposing a Western concept on South Africa's people. The combined ideologies of the King Center and the Transformation Center and our shared emphasis on nonpartisanship also helped us avoid trouble from the heated divisions that had flared up between Mandela's party, the ANC, which was primarily Xhosa, and the primarily Zulu Inkatha Freedom Party, headed by the powerful chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi. So, as the unprecedented election, the first in which all South African citizens could vote, neared, seeds of nonviolence were planted. But we were aware that seeds of violence were plenteous as well. Alarming news headlines in papers such as the London Daily Mail predicted a race war fueled by right-wing whites. Reports of potential all-out violence between the ANC and the Zulus also increased. Chief Buthelezi warned his followers to brace for violence and even death. Townships around the country were rife with violence. The ANC's headquarters in the Shell House in Johannesburg were bombed in April 1994, 2 days before the election. 9 people died, and the Zulus were blamed for this attack. Meanwhile, ANC guards had reportedly shot 8 demonstrators. Our staff, working alongside South African activists, were armed with little more than their Bibles and their faith that a peaceful transition was not only necessary, but achievable. All around us, emergency plans were being made. there was a scheme in place to airlift up to 350,000 Britons out of South Africa should the country slide into chaos. Shortly before the election, our State Department recommended that all American workers leave South Africa because of the virtual certainty that violence would overwhelm the country. Nevertheless, our small staff persevered. In an effort to maintain our nonpartisan image with the different groups, our trainers wore aprons with the King Center emblem embossed on the front and the King Luthuli emblem on the back. These men and women might have been killed if they had appeared to be siding with the wrong faction. As our aides traveled through the countryside, South African police often searched their automobiles for materials that could be construed as propaganda to benefit one side or the other, materials we did not carry. Despite the potential for violence, our methods were so successful that the U.S. State Department rescinded its prior order for all groups to leave South Africa a week before the election. Charles Alphen Sr. told us that we ended up being the only American group allowed to stay. We had helped train more than 300,000 people to do something they had never done before, participate in a truly democratic election. A great example of how far South Africa had come in terms of race relations was the awarding of the 1993 Nobel Peace Prize to F.W. de Klerk, the white former president of South Africa, and Mandela. They shared the honor for their work in ending apartheid. De Klerk was the seventh and last president of the apartheid era. When he took office in 1989, he released Mandela from prison the next year and lifted a ban on the ANC that had been in place since shortly after the Soweto riots in 1976. In 1994, not a lot of activists in or out of South Africa had put as much faith in a peaceful outcome as I had. But shortly after Mandela's release from prison in 1990, I heard white Afrikaners say that they expected blacks to start shooting whites, and they were shocked when this did not happen. And in another chapter of the same story, after the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves in the United States, these men, women, and children did not respond to the brutalities of their imprisonment with violence toward their former masters. That, too, is amazing. It is God's work, and it's important for me to say that. That overall peace was maintained in South Africa in April 1994 is also a credit to Nelson Mandela. He set the tone of calm and stability by the sheer force of his personality and the power of his negotiating skills. Rather than calling for anger and revenge, Nelson's philosophy, which so closely paralleled Martin's, emphasized reconciliation between all people. If he could emerge from 27 years of imprisonment and forgive his captors, it seemed possible for his supporters to do likewise. On April 27, 1994, Nelson and the African National Congress won the election with 62% of the vote. Buthelezi's Inkatha Freedom Party earned about 10%. On May 9, 1994, news photographers captured my jubilation as I danced the toy toy with Nelson at the Carlton Hotel in Johannesburg, celebrating his victory. As I glanced over my shoulder, I saw even uniformed police officers dancing. On that remarkable evening, I listened joyfully as Nelson praised Martin for helping provide the climate and the King Center for helping train thousands of participants in the tactics of nonviolence. Nelson made the transition from 27 years of imprisonment to his role as leader of his nation, all without massive bloodshed. As I stood beside Nelson, I thought of how Martin had once said he was prepared to die to see his dream of a society in which blacks and whites were equal become a reality. And there we were, Nelson and I, joined in an embrace of victory. This great freedom fighter lifted my hand as we danced alongside the thousands of jubilant celebrants. We were two symbols of the rich harvest of a long-suffering yet fruitful revolution on the parts of the dispossessed, an uprising that miraculously changed the oppressors as well as their oppressed. Nelson's election was one of the largest nonviolent democratic transitions of the 20th century. Few thought they would ever witness the patient and peaceful assembly of millions of South Africans who queued in lines that extended for miles to vote, braving the threat of bombs planted by those still living out the emotional scars of apartheid. I personally felt a sense of unapologetic joy on that night. I saw God's timing in this miraculous historical breakthrough. I had prophesied that divine intervention could not only save but also redeem South Africa. The Holy Spirit works through people. You do all you can, and then God takes over. He creates the breakthroughs in our lives that make these kinds of miraculous historical events eminently possible. When God decides a change is coming, He uses people who will be obedient to His purpose and will. Then miraculous things begin to happen. That election was a powerful vindication of nonviolence resistance and its message, so often stated by Martin. We must either learn to live together as brothers, or we perish together as fools. Sadly, during the years we were working on peacekeeping in South Africa, Jesse Jackson and several of the men who had been my husband's top aides were, once again, involved in opposing the center's efforts in the United States. In past years, I had been wounded by Jesse's self-serving moves. Then in 1990, the year Nelson was freed from prison, I felt that Randall Robinson, leader of Trans Africa and others, were putting their interests in the way of our doing our best work in support of those we were called to serve. These critics, sometimes publicly, sometimes secretly, stated that it was wrong for the King Center to be involved at all in South Africa. They argued that we should stick to civil rights. I felt these criticisms were a painful burden, especially as some of these critics had worked closely with my husband. Although I was carrying out the same mission as Martin, they now seemed to be working just as hard against me as they had worked with him. But as the biblical story of Joseph demonstrates, what some mean for evil, God will turn around for our good. Why am I talking about the sordid side of leadership now? Because future leaders need to know how to work together as a team, and how to avoid infighting, which hurts many and helps no one. Overall, our efforts on civil rights may be more effective if personalities, inflated egos, turf issues, and jealousies could be set aside for the bigger picture. How much more could be accomplished if we could work together rather than against one another? Yet, despite the problems I've had, I have no hard feelings toward Randall or Jesse. In fact, in 1993, I presented the Reverend Jackson with the Martin Luther King Jr. Nonviolent Peace Prize, the center's highest award. Jesse has made many valuable contributions to our country. No matter what has happened to me personally, the cause is greater than any individual. All people have human frailties. Certainly I am no exception. In all honesty, I hurt like any human being. But I have fought very hard not to allow my private wounds to blot out the good I see in others. I took the same approach with Ralph Abernathy, who died of a heart attack shortly before Nelson Mandela's historic visit to the United States and the King Center. People often ask me how I felt about the negative accusations he made in his autobiography, And the Walls Came Tumbling Down, where he claimed that my husband slapped around a spurned lover and then left his room to stay with another woman until the wee hours of the morning the night before he was killed. If Ralph were to be believed, on the evening of April 2, 1968, after Martin, a deeply religious man, made one of the most prophetic and anointed sermons of his lifetime, I've Been to the Mountaintop, he descended from the pulpit and engaged in this sordid behavior. First of all, I know my husband, and this would have been totally out of character for him. I also had a conversation with Martin earlier that evening. Although I do not need to rely on any of Martin's aides to substantiate or vouch for his whereabouts, not one of them said they saw or heard anything like what Ralph alleges occurred. These kinds of revelations were mind-boggling, especially coming from Ralph, my husband's closest confidant, counselor, and cellmate. They ate and drank together. They marched side by side during the protests that brought down Jim Crow segregation in the South. When my husband was shot down, it was Ralph who cradled him in his arms as the blood seethed from his wounds. All this makes Ralph's incredible falsehood about his best friend especially disturbing. Many people have asked me to react to Ralph's claim. Before now, I could not divulge my deeper feelings. I issued a very guarded statement to the news media. But what I really felt was this. I knew Ralph had run into financial difficulty. Scandal sells books. Fidelity does not. Bad news about the unsavory behavior of a good man is a better page-turner than anything I have to say about my husband, a man who felt so guilty about the smallest infraction or sin that he could not carry the weight of it without telling me. As his wife, I know my husband. If Martin had an affair, I would have known it. I don't have one instance of proof of Martin's infidelity, not one. The fact that Ralph said those things about Martin does not make them true. I was in Harare, Zimbabwe in 1990, celebrating the country's 10th anniversary of independence, when I learned that Ralph had died on April 17th in Atlanta. I issued a statement which in part read, "When our home was bombed and our lives were threatened, he was there. His strength as a tactician and a counselor to Martin during our struggle has been eloquently recorded in Martin's own writings and in the annals of American civil rights movement." I hurried back for the homegoing, which was held at West Hunter Street Baptist Church in Atlanta, where Ralph had served for many years as pastor. As we laid Ralph to rest, there were absolutely no hard feelings on my part or on the part of my family. We still had unconditional love for Ralph. Speaking at the funeral, Martin's sister Christine King Farris described, "The Ralph I remember is like a member of our family, Uncle Ralph." And in the years afterward, I never lost touch with the Abernathy family. As the King Center developed, I was able to both dialogue with powerful leaders, including prime ministers and presidents, and participate in protests alongside rank-and-file working people of all races. I met with many great spiritual leaders, too, including Pope John Paul II, the Dalai Lama, Dorothy Day, and my friend Pastor Robert Schuller of the Crystal Cathedral. By the mid-80s, I could richly appreciate the influence that God had given me to make a difference in the lives of others. It allowed me to pick up a phone and have my calls put through to presidents, queens, princes, mayors, governors, heads of state, and CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. These calls enabled me to help people, to promote good people, to intervene in situations that were going wrong. I even witnessed the historic handshake between Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Chairman Yasser Arafat at the signing of the Middle East Peace Accords in 1993. In 1984, in Washington, D.C., I met with the ambassadors to the United States from 40 African nations. We discussed ways to strengthen economic and diplomatic relations and focus more attention on resolving the issues of poverty and hunger. The meeting was arranged by Raouf Ghonim from the Embassy of the Arab Republic of Egypt and hosted by Gito Washington, Ambassador to Washington from the Republic of Liberia. In 1988, in preparation for the Reagan-Gorbachev talks, I served as the head of the U.S. delegation of women for a meaningful summit in Athens, Greece. And in 1990, as the USSR was redefining itself, I was a convener of the Soviet-American Women's Summit in Washington, D.C. Some of my most unforgettable and remarkable experiences came through meeting various world leaders. Some, such as Indira Gandhi and Corazon Aquino, became my dearest friends. Some of my international interactions, however, are memorable because of the unexpected incidents that occurred. On June 10, 1994, Emperor Akihito of Japan and his wife, Empress Machiko, visited the King Center after lunching with President Jimmy Carter. I think I will always remember that day because of what went awry. For 14 centuries, Japanese citizens were taught that the emperor was a direct descendant of the sun goddess. Although Akihito's father, Hirohito, renounced the notion of godhood, even the slightest hint of disrespect is viewed as shockingly unacceptable by the emperor's countrymen. We knew this, And we knew that, for whatever reason, it was not customary for the emperor to shake hands with people. Yet when the emperor arrived, Reverend Hosea Williams, one of my husband's former aides, grabbed his hand and lectured him, saying that he found Japanese people to be very disrespectful of black Americans. He loudly challenged the emperor, telling him, "We spend $13 billion a year on Japanese products, and not a single black American has a Japanese franchise." The emperor just smiled and nodded. I know he doesn't speak English very well, so I wasn't certain he understood. The New York Times, on the other hand, understood very clearly what was happening and ran an article on it. On a sadder note, I also responded to the call from my friend Corazon Aquino when her husband was assassinated on August 23, 1983. Corazon and I had met at the United Nations and we became fast friends. When her husband Menino was killed, I broke away from my trip in Africa to be by her side. Her subsequent rise to the presidency of the Philippines was quite spectacular. She considered herself to be an ordinary housewife. But when her husband was killed, Corazon, usually attired in her signature yellow dresses, led a people's revolution that in 1986 toppled the 21-year authoritarian rule of President Ferdinand Marcos and restored democracy to the Philippines. She became the first female president in Asia. Over the years, we enjoyed teasing each other about our shared nickname. Her formal name is Maria Corazon Sumulong Cojuangco Aquino, but she was called Cori. My husband and a few close friends always called me Cori. Another one of my closest friends was Indira Gandhi, the first female prime minister of India, and one of the first women elected to lead her country in the modern era. She remained in office close to 12 years, which set a record. I first met her when Martin and I toured India in 1957 and visited with her father, then the prime minister. Indira was serving as her father's chief of staff. Later, when she became prime minister, I returned to India to accept the Nehru Award for Outstanding International Leadership from her. Indira was elected in January 1966. At that time, as the world's second most populous nation, India had 1.2 billion people. In 1982, following the world premiere of Sir Richard Attenborough's film Gandhi, CBS, which had produced the televised version, paid my expenses so that I might attend a reception at Indira's home. As usual, she was dressed in an elegant hand-woven sari. Unlike the palatial estate of her father, Jawaharlal Nehru, Indira's home was very modest, a place where even the very poor would feel comfortable visiting. In fact, she had become a champion of the poor and had found acclaim as the leader of India's Green Revolution. Her administration took on the problem of serious food shortages, which affected mainly the extremely poor Sikh farmers of the Punjab region, increasing crop diversification and food exports as a way out of the problem. Indira's strategy opened up new job opportunities as well. During my visit, we talked about our hopes of ending the arms race, and she confided in me her worries about a growing extremist separatist Sikh movement in India, which was threatening to divide the nation. In our public addresses, Indira and I both called vigorously for an end to the Vietnam War. Through the United Nations, in her capacity as a leader of the non-aligned nations, and through my syndicated columns, press conferences, and talks with the Nixon administration, we pressed our anti-war message. We also garnered criticism at the highest levels for doing so. By watching her close up, I came to understand some of the strengths and perils of women at the top, particularly the ways that women can be condemned for doing exactly the same things for which their male predecessors are praised. On the brighter side, as early as the 1950s, and partially because of Mahatma Gandhi's commitment to the advancement of women, I saw how some Indian women held much higher positions than women at home. There were women in Parliament. In 1959, even the Chief Justice of India's Supreme Court was a woman. Imagine that. I know that someday, women in the United States will lead our country, not only in the highest court of the land, but at the top as president. On October 31, 1984, I received the heartbreaking call that I think she'd been trying to warn me about. Indira had been assassinated. It was so agonizing, so shocking. According to the reports, her trusted bodyguard, who was a Sikh, pulled out a .38-caliber revolver and shot her at point-blank range. Another bodyguard, also a Sikh, then took out an automatic weapon, firing 30 rounds into her body. She died on the way to the hospital. Immediately, I thought about how crazy these assassinations were. I believe firmly that people at the highest levels must plot and plan such things. I just can't believe that someone's own bodyguard would do such a thing unless he or she had been paid to do it. To make matters even more horrible, years later, on May 21, 1991, Indira's son Rajiv, who'd followed in her footsteps as India's prime minister and was such a beautiful person, was also assassinated. Before Indira's death, however, she helped us establish a permanent memorial to Mahatma Gandhi, whose birthday we celebrated annually at the King Center on October 2nd. We have a Gandhi room in our Freedom Hall, which contained his sandals, his eyeglasses, his walking cane, one of his prayer rugs, and a very nice picture of him. Indira personally ensured our receipt of many of his original possessions. I miss my friend. She was such a brave soul. The American Civil Rights Movement and the King Center helped provide the leadership and inspiration, as well as the training in strategy, tactics, and the moral capacities of nonviolence that captivated nations from Europe to Asia, from Africa to Central America. As early as 1989, we saw free elections in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Brazil, and Namibia, Africa's last colony. We witnessed hundreds of thousands of people marching through the streets of Berlin and Beijing, Budapest and Pretoria, Moscow, Warsaw, and Prague, singing "We Shall Overcome" in a host of languages. They sang in Bantu and German, Tagalog, and Polish, sang the same song of freedom we once sang in the streets of Birmingham, Montgomery, and Little Rock. The U.S. Information Agency published and distributed materials on the King Center in the Russian language throughout the Soviet Union. When Daddy King, Mama King, and my sister-in-law, Christine King Farris, visited Hungary in 1978, they found no fewer than five churches named after Martin. The Solidarity Movement in Poland also used the documentary Montgomery to Memphis, which we use as a nonviolence training film at the center. Students in the Chinese Freedom Movement were photographed in news magazines carrying signs and wearing T-shirts that displayed the words, "We shall overcome." Martin often challenged world leaders to create a new foreign policy, one that would replace the evils of racism, poverty, and militarism with a new set of values dependent on moral power rather than military might. Shortly before his assassination, Martin had strongly urged the institutionalizing and internationalizing of our nonviolent strategies. He felt they were vitally needed to continue the flow of democratic movements around the world. And without a doubt, institutionalizing and internationalizing nonviolence is our goal at the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change. We walk and work where Martin would have walked and worked if he'd been allowed to live. As we continue expanding the cause from civil to human rights, we are committed to keeping alive Martin's dream of nonviolent global policies that, whenever possible, choose diplomacy over war and always show respect for human lives over hate, revenge, and bitterness.
Context of white supremacy. That is the first audio segment, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, the autobiography of the late Mrs. Coretta Scott King. So we just ended chapter 19. The next chapter will deal with making Dr. King's birthday a national holiday, which was quite an odyssey for folks who were not alive then or younger folks. But anyway, if you have commentary you would like to share on the first portion, the number to dial 641-715-3663. 40. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. Code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyTiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tinyTiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. When you put in that address, click the link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. When you click that, it'll open a small window on your screen. Top line, it's a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again, 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can use your real name, nickname, press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast, and you should be able to hear us participate. If you want to talk, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 61. Same procedure if you call in via phone. Star 61, and we'll get you on the line and share your thoughts. Witness to apartheid. Man, oh man, I want to make sure I say that. I'll say it multiple times. That's one of the best documentaries, although I do have one in my library that I haven't even had an opportunity to watch. It is supposed to be amazing. It's like an 8-hour doc. That's why I haven't seen it. It's 8 hours, but it's supposed to be absolutely amazing. PBS documentary on apartheid. It goes into the Kodak film industry and how they were culpable. When we talk about a global system, like the details, what does that mean? How does each and every individual white person contribute to the global empire of white supremacy? Great. I'll have to get the documentary title before it wraps. But Witness to Apartheid is amazing, and it's not 8 hours. It's, I think, like 90 minutes. It got nominated for an Academy Award, but it is absolutely amazing. It gives so much brutal detail. And the reason I have to bring it up so emphatically, in fact, I won't even comment because I wait till everybody else shares. If you have commentary, feel free. Looking forward to hearing what folks have to say about this week's portion of the dialogue. So everyone who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Feel free to share.
Can I be heard?
May I be heard?
We'll get the female caller first.
I'm sorry, I'll be quick. Thank you for taking my call. This is a black female caller from Ohio. The first thing I noted was that I feel like, once again, it seems like it's a recurring theme throughout the book, is how whites continuously use Mrs. King, her image, and everything that her husband stood for to further their own political, social, personal gain. I definitely felt that the President Botha, was doing that as far as wanting her to meet with the Mandelas, and as far as definitely with the photo op, which definitely seems like something that suspected racist white supremacists love to do. The other thing was I like the fact how when she met with one of the ANC activists and she told them that you could use economic sanctions as a form of nonviolence. I thought that was definitely interesting. The other quick notes, I saw how it seems like, of course, Mahatma Gandhi, his influence is, of course, present in this chapter as well. But there's no reference to how he was before. One second. I thought it was a show of black self-respect as far as how she didn't really hold any grudges against Randall or Jesse Jackson, despite the fact of what she heard that they could have possibly been doing, but that could have been racist interference. And I thought it was definitely interesting how she kind of seemed like she was, she felt really bad for Mrs. Mandela, and how she was just bringing up some of the things that she went through as far as her being tortured and being under surveillance. And I thought that was interesting because she dealt with that same thing, which I feel like, or it could definitely just be me, how it seemed like she didn't really consider the torment and the surveillance that she was going through as something as being traumatic. And I guess the last thing that I would mention was that I'm definitely glad to learn more about apartheid because I've been wanting to learn more about that, and I thought it was definitely interesting how they, because I didn't know the numbers as far as there being 35 million black Africans, and yet they were still under the rule of 4.3 million white Afrikaners. So that's all I had. Thank you.
Oh, that's such an... Oh, it's Have You Heard from Johannesburg? That's the same name as Gil Scott Heron's song, Have You Heard from Johannesburg. I play it on the compensatory call-in sometime. But that is the amazing eight-hour documentary that is in my library that I have not watched yet because it is 8 hours, but it's amazing. Like, I've seen portions of it, and that's why I have it. I own, like, a hard copy of it. But I would definitely encourage folks to check that out, Witness to Apartheid. And I thought that was just a incredibly important point about the comparison between Coretta Scott King and Winnie Mandela. And we did Long Walk to Freedom. I forgot the autobiography of Nelson Mandela for folks who are interested. Absolutely. We've had a lot of guests on from South Africa, too. But I mean, hey, we spent months right after he passed in 2013 on Long Walk to Freedom. And that was a very informative read for many reasons. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, do you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to the callers and listeners. Just a few things. The experience with the South Africa. I find the interesting part of when she mentioned about the dissension amongst the tribes and the, you know, it kind of reminds me the history of colonialism. You know, the offspring of racism. Basically works hand in hand, and how it divided a lot of the tribes, and it even permeated to, you know, her thing with Randall Robinson and Jesse Jackson in regards to trying to, you know, fight apartheid. So, you know, it goes to show you how the effects of, you know, white colonialism has done to South Africa, and even to this day, it still affects them. Talking about, you know, it's interesting. She talked about when the election of Nelson Mandela, how that was divine intervention. And I heard that same phrase when Barack Obama got elected. So, and, you know, just like with the Obama election, South Africa, nothing is, from my understanding, has really changed in regards to, you know, Nelson Mandela's election. So, I thought that was also interesting. You know, it was also interesting when she talked about her her interactions with some of the wives of some of the leaders and some of the female leaders around the world. One of them she mentioned was a Corazon Aquino. I think I mentioned this before, but my mother's Filipino. I spent time in the Philippines. And she mentioned how, and this is something that was always popular with her, about how she was just an ordinary housewife. But what they don't say is Aquino came from the Conjunco family in the Philippines, and they are a very, very rich family. So people in the Philippines don't understand, like, why is she just calling herself an ordinary housewife? You know, she comes from a rich line, you know, rich family line. So I kind of caught that as well. That's all I have. I'll mute my line.
Right on. Appreciate that additional information. I did not know that. If other folks have commentary, hopefully people won't spectate as they partake. If you have commentary, get a hand up as well. The female caller in Ohio, you can let us know since you have been calling in regular. If you have a title, something you would like us to call you other than female caller in Ohio, the other one of two female callers in Ohio. How did you conclude that she didn't harbor, I think, if I recall correctly, like any like vengeance or, you know, spite for Randall Robinson and Jesse Jackson? How did you conclude that?
I'm still thinking of a name, by the way, but I'll let you know. And I was just basically from what she said, I don't have the page number, but it says, yet despite the problems I've had, I have no hard feelings towards Randall or Jesse. And that's what she wrote. I know that it seems like what we had discussed in the past as far as her death, like describing in much more detail what non-white people have done to her versus what races have done to her. But I guess I would just, I don't know, maybe being hopeful with that passage.
Right on. I like that. Being right on the text. I dig it. I dig it. let's see. I took a few notes here. I did not enjoy this week's session or last week's session as much as I did like the first portion of the book. I almost feel like Felicia Rashad's portion of the book has been the portion that I have least enjoyed. I almost feel like it's gotten progressively worse as we have progressed through the text. Even with that said, and I think she said last week that this is so similar to Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough. The second half, absolutely. This feels absolutely like the prequel or the sequel or however you want to phrase it. But absolutely another brilliant point from the great Emmy. Some of the notes that I took, I'm having to make sure I don't spill into last week here. Okay, I think everything from here is from this week, from chapter 18. This is last week. That's why I'm having to make sure I don't spill back into last week from the chapter. Okay. This is all last week. And all right. Everything from chapter 19, excuse. I felt like, one of the things, I guess, that has been a greater issue, the second portion of the book, it feels like a lot of proselytizing. When I say proselytizing, like having a dogmatic stance on something. Like I have a dogmatic stance on white people should not have sexual intercourse, any sort of sexual activity with non-white people. But I do not go around proselytizing that, meaning I am not going out trying to convince every non-white person that I come in contact with that you should not have sexual intercourse with a white person, even though maybe some people say you should be doing that. But I really do not like that. I do not like people that are just very aggressive with a stance, and it's got to be like dogmatic. And when I say dogmatic, like it has got to be this and it can't be anything else. I'm totally with nonviolence as a strategy. I am nonviolent pretty much every day, just by default. I think most people are nonviolent just by default. But just saying that it has to be that permanently and then having to go around and I would say aggressively. I mean, if you're going around and talking about this on a regular basis and, you know, she's
kind of critiquing softly Winnie Mandela because she's, you know, seeming like she's having some issues with committing to this in a very dogmatic, consistent, you know, never an option for self-defense. That just, you know, does not strike me as being logical in a system of racism, white supremacy. And the reason that I mentioned Witness for Apartheid, let me pause in my commentary, Desmond Tutu is in Witness to Apartheid, as are many other members. I think some of P.W. Botha's family members are in Witness to Apartheid, if I remember. In fact, I've played one of audio clips. I should have started with that this week. There were so many juicy things, but she talks about that's one of the great reasons to why it's two great reasons to watch it. Number one, one of P.W. Botha's family members, who was the former president of South Africa, leader of apartheid white terrorism in that area of the world, one of his white female family members said, if we do not maintain domination over the Kaffirs, we will all be chocolate colored. I'm paraphrasing, but she for sure said chocolate colored, and I've sound clipped that on this program before. The other really important reason to watch that documentary and why it relates to this text, Desmond Tutu, Nobel Prize winner Desmond Tutu, said people who, and this came out in the 80s, like apartheid was still rolling. Nelson Mandela was still in prison when this documentary was made, for context. He said the people, young people, who critique nonviolence, critique us and say, you know, all this nonviolence is a bunch of nonsense. You all have been talking that foolishness for how many ever years, and white people are still crushing us, and we're still, you know, Nelson Mandela is still in prison. And he said, you know what? They're absolutely right, because we have not produced the goods. And further, what we have seen is that this is all Desmond Tutu, Witness to Apartheid. He says further, for nonviolence to be effective, the opposition must have some moral minimum, meaning there must be some level of abuse or mistreatment where they, oh, whoa, we can't do that. We can't do that. We have to think of something else. And he says consistently, whites have shown that that does not exist with how it relates to black people. One of the most important statements I think Desmond Tutu has ever made. It's in Witness to Apartheid. That's what I think. Like, this is just nonsense. Like, everything has to be evaluated. What I say has to be evaluated. This is absolute nonsense. Just talking about, it was, I mean, rhetoric. I just heard rhetoric. It's just lots and lots of flowery rhetoric. If this is how Mrs. King really felt, then I would just say she's a victim of racism. She's entitled to her view, but it does not make sense. It is not even something that I would deem worthy of, you know, a lot of attention, because it just doesn't match up with logic. If this is on the author, Reverend Dr. Barbara Reynolds, and that is important, Reverend, because I'm using the term proselytizing, because that's what Christians do. That's what people that are a member of some religious practices, they proselytize. You have to go out and get other people to accept your faith and, you know, abide by the rules of your faith or abide by the rules of nonviolence. It just sounds very similar. She is a reverend and a doctor, but some of it, she's the author, so some of it could be, it could be even a combination of the two things. But however it's done, it has been very, very unenjoyable. And I can go through here and cite out a few more things from this week's reading. Yeah, when she says, like, in a nonviolent conflict, there's no rancor left behind, and in the end, the enemies are converted into friends. That was my experience in South Africa with General Smuts. This is the words of Mahatma Gandhi. The system of white supremacy is still in existence. That's what I mean. Like, these, and this is someone who was assassinated. I mean, these things have to be evaluated. And it just, I mean, you can come to your own conclusions about what you think, but I mean, it's just flowery rhetoric. And that's a lot of what I heard when Dr. King spoke, a lot of metaphors. It's a lot of pulling in like Christian biblical parables and what have you to help make these points, or in my opinion, as just a part of the emotional appeal of all of this. It sounds good. It feels good. But it's just that when you look at this in the system of white supremacy, when she says, and then when I read about Randall Robinson, like, she may have said that, you know, she didn't have any rancor, she didn't have any ill will towards Randall Robinson and Jesse Jackson. But man, I cannot think of any other white people in this text. And with Jesse Jackson, it's like repeatedly bringing up things that he did or he said about her, or, you know, not supporting her at the King Center or her funding efforts or what have you, or, you know, why she didn't want to support his presidential campaign. I cannot think of any white people that she has spent this much time in detail, like talking about her problems or frustrations with an individual white person, particularly when I compare this to the way, like the glorified terms that she's used to talk about, like John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy, and even the white dude she was dating at Antioch College for a little while, and some of the other whites, even last week, I think, when she was talking about some of the European countries that she went to and the white people, she said specifically going to white European countries, and they received her so well, like to contrast that with the way that she's talking about victims of white supremacy, Jesse Jackson and Randall Robinson. I think Black self-respect is bragging about being nonviolent in word and deed with other Black people. That certainly does not mean you have to agree with every Black person. I frustrate a lot of Black people. I do not always treat other Black people correctly. I know Black people are frustrated with Gus T. Renegade. I am frustrated with other Black people, but I'm certainly not. When it's time to write my book, As a Victim of Racism, White Supremacy, you can rest assured that it will not take up large sections or even tiny sections complaining about, you know, that time that this Black person got on my nerves and made it difficult. I mean, that is absurd in a system of racism, white supremacy, where white people are most to blame for all of this, including how Black people are behaving. Our behavior is nothing but a response, and a pitiful response at that. And you can put, you know, Gus at the top of the list for that. Other things that stood out. I got that about Randall Robinson. The word reconciliation was used a lot. I've said consistently that, in my view, is not an accurate term that should be used when talking about racism, white supremacy. Reconcile, it suggests, implies that the two parties that are now in conflict, that at some previous point, they got along. And no one has been able to demonstrate when that period would be for individuals classified as white and the rest of us. Also, great point. I cannot emphasize enough, because absolutely everything that she says about Winnie and Nelson Mandela was Dr. King and Coretta Scott King, the separation due to jail, although certainly it wasn't as long, but she talked about, you know, what a harrowing experience that was, him repeatedly being locked up and what could have happened to him, subjected to house arrest, kept under surveillance, held in solitary confinement at Pretoria Central Prison for a year and a half, and then banished to a remote town. Pretty much all of these things happened in addition to having her house bombed. And I guess that is one thing that I will get in. Coretta Scott King, she's a victim of white supremacy, VGQ, Victims Guaranteed Qualified. She can take whatever perspective she wants on racism, as can anyone else. I can totally understand how any Black person being subjected to the type of terrorism and torture that she, throughout her life, I think that's the word I've been using the whole time, trauma in reading this book, everything that she had to deal with from house being bombed as a child all the way through, I can totally understand how you would, man, I've had all the violence that I want for, you know, eight generations. You know, I don't want to see any violent movies. I don't want to imagine about any, I don't want to see any violent cartoons. Like, I can totally understand I'm just saying, in my view, being dogmatic, proselytizing, and saying that that's the only way that we can look at solving the problem of white supremacy. It doesn't make sense. And Desmond Tutu is in agreement, according to Witness to Apartheid. Neck lacing, when they talked about that and rumors that Winnie Mandela endorsed that, again, be nonviolent with other Black people. I just wrote about that for Atlanta Black Star, being nonviolent with other Black people, inspired by this text where she talked about being nonviolent in word and deed, that if we could commit to doing that with other Black people, wow, that would be so important. One other thing I did want to say, when she talked about the infighting and what have you, I thought that was a really important segment where she talked about in working against racism, white supremacy, kind of recognizing the bigger picture. I thought that was hugely important. However, I think as long as white supremacy exists, I think the record has shown whites are phenomenal. They excel at creating conflict between non-white people. You can expect the infighting. I think, as Mr. Fuller suggests, you just try to work to minimize that as best you can. And I suspect that what Mr. Fuller calls four-wallism, where you have organizations that get together where you pay dues and you meet at a certain time, or maybe you get an office building or what have you, and this is your formal organization, what Mr. Fuller calls four-wallism, that the infighting is going to happen there. Just because you have a lot of victims of racism, it's very easy for non-white people, for racists to infiltrate these organizations. Either they do it with white people, they do it with non-white people, they do it both, and they got all kinds of surveillance and what have you now with electronics and what have you. So it's easy for them to manipulate and control these groups. She talked about that being they were doing it in South Africa with the ANC and the anti-apartheid effort. They were doing it with the SCLC and NAACP, Black Panthers, Black Lives Matter. They do it here. So, I mean, you just got to understand that's how the system works. And again, she did say she was naive about that aspect before. The commentary with Nelson Mandela, I think of number one. Again, I mentioned we did Long Walk to Freedom. We also did Medical Apartheid, top five of Gus's, where she talks about apartheid, and specifically she talks about Nelson Mandela. She talks about the campaigns, international white supremacy campaigns, chemical and biological warfare campaigns to poison Black anti-apartheid workers like Nelson Mandela, talking about poisoning him in jail so that he would not be effective in leading the movement against white supremacy. And one of these whites, Bassan, prepared a meal for Mandela to eat while he was still in prison. That all of that medical apartheid, Harriet Washington, phenomenal text. I thought about all of that when I read this, when she was saying how it was so great that Madiba was able to get out of confinement and not have bitterness and rancor towards the whites in South Africa. And it's like, we don't even know how he had been neutralized just by his confinement. Whites do experiments, medical apartheid. Whites do experiments. We don't even know what they did to modify his behavior to get him to function the way that he was functioning once he was released from prison. Dr. Welsing talked about that at the Welsing Institute right after he passed. I'm still working to get that audio. Let's see some of the other things that I thought. Yeah, it was a lot of pushing of the nonviolence and name dropping. That's one of the things that I felt a lot in this second segment. I think I in kind of the second portion of the text, kind of since Felicia Rashad has been moderating, that it seems like a lot of name dropping, like all of these important people that stopped by the King Center or that she got to meet. And that's not what I enjoyed about the first portion of the book. It didn't feel like it was just name dropping people that were involved in the civil rights movement. Like, it felt like getting into a lot of details about how these things were happening and getting a lot of, you know, really new, fresh insight about what her thoughts were about things that were happening, things I didn't know before about her childhood and things. And this just feels like name dropping of all these cool folks and important people that, you know, have hung out and talked with down through the years. I checked that article. She mentions this kerfuffle with Reverend Hosea Williams and the emperor from Japan when he comes to Atlanta, and he kind of checks him about the Japanese disrespect of Black people. That is in the New York Times. I checked it out, and she kind of quotes kind of directly from some of the things that they said in the New York Times article. I do not have a problem with anti-Blackness being confronted. VGQ. Yeah, I don't have a problem. And I'll leave that there. I'm very curious when she was talking about the King Center and she said institutionalizing and internationalizing. What does she mean when she says institutionalizing? Because that did not come through explicitly for me. Does that mean getting like King Centers? Does that mean training people in nonviolence through their paradigm and then replicating it? Like when they helped the Black male from South Africa get, you know, build his own center and take those principles from the King Center and transfer them to South Africa. Is that what it means? Like, what do they mean when they say institutionalizing their concept of nonviolence and the principles that Dr. King espoused? I will stop there. Let me check in and see. Other folks have commentary, questions. So we have other folks that have a hand up. Folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary you would like to share, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. This caller from the 712. This is a great read this week, and I want to answer the question that you asked. I think it was the last reading from last week about the transition from it going to one voice into Felicia Rashad's voice, and I didn't mind it that much. Seems like they maybe set it up to where Miss King was more mature, so they bought Felicia Rashad in, and then when the other lady was reading, she was younger back then, and that was kind of the younger voice. But I enjoyed how they did that. And the, like I said, a lot of good information, but the two things that stood out on this reading was when she said she went to South Africa and her people were upset with her because she decided not to take security. And I wish, I don't know what it is with a lot of black people feeling like we don't need security. We need security. And it reminded me of when Malcolm X, he also told, when we read the autobiography of Malcolm X, he also told his people that he didn't need security. So I just wish we would get that through our head that we need security. We probably need our own black security agency. But that's the one thing. And the other thing that I'm up here at work, and when it said, I'm a paraphrase. I think she said, I can tell that things were going to be okay in South Africa because the clerk got the Nobel Peace Prize, and I was just like, at work, and people were like, why are you screaming? I'm like, nothing. But, yeah, those are the two things that stood out. And like you were saying, Gus, when the man went to shake the Japanese prime minister's hand or emperor's hand, and, you know, just talking to him, he said, you know, that he probably doesn't understand English, but the New York Times get it right or whatever, and he'll get the message. But I was okay with that because, you know, that was anti-blackness, and he was calling them on it. And those are the three things that I took note of today. So thank you for letting me talk.
In fact, I'm gonna read you what the New York Times says about this this incident from June 11, 1994. Appreciate that female caller dialing in from work, because I did think that was important as well. The F.W. de Klerk getting the Nobel Peace Prize. That is similar. Dr. Henry Kissinger, he was brought up in this book before. I think Mrs. King, she met him, and he admitted that he was wrong about the Vietnam stance, that she and her husband were correct. He got a Nobel Peace Prize, too. That's what I mean about racists. They just clown so hard that a lot of these titles and awards, they don't really mean anything anyway. But this is back to the New York Times report. Japan's emperor unflappable in Atlanta. This is June 11, 1994. Mild as the challenge was by some... Wait a minute. But the emperor's somewhat unimperial mixing with commoners and extending of his hand to total strangers backfired a bit this afternoon. During a reception at the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change, the Reverend Hosea Williams, the veteran civil rights campaigner, told the emperor that he found Japanese people to be very disrespectful of black Americans. "We spend $13 billion a year on Japanese products," Mr. Williams said loudly, clinging to the emperor's hand, "and not a single black American has a Japanese franchise. Not one." A smile and a nod. The challenge was translated into the highly formal Japanese used in the royal household. The emperor and empress held their perfect smiles. Then the emperor nodded and responded that he was very pleased indeed to meet the reverend. No more was said, and the party moved on, escorted by Coretta Scott King. Mild as the challenge was by some standards, that sort of direct confrontation is what the royal household has risked by jettisoning the emperor to Atlanta and to cities including Charleston, South Carolina, Dillon Roof, Charlottesville, Virginia, New York, St. Louis, and Los Angeles, in addition to a state dinner with President Clinton in Washington. We will conclude there. that's the New York Times report. That's what you get when you hang out with commoners like Reverend Hosea Williams. New York Times, keeping it classy. Did any of the other folks have commentary that they wanted to share this week's first portion of the reading?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to add about when you were mentioning about Mandela and his time in prison and how that has changed him in a very, you know, strange way. Because I thought about what happened with Huey P. Newton when he served jail time in 1968 and how when he got out in 1970, how that changed him significantly, because I think his behavior changed and everything. So I wouldn't put it past if whites were doing something to these people while they were in prison. So that's all I wanted to add.
Great addition. White people do experiments. White people do experiments. That is extremely important. And again, a lot of times we don't even know like the breadth of things that are happening to us. I think the same thing. In fact, I think that has been true for all of the autobiographies that we've read of black people. I don't know if I'll remember them all right now, but the ones that I can think of just immediately, Dr. Maya Angelou, Malcolm X, Nelson Mandela, Assata Shakur. This one, I think that's a good point. For Richard Williams, I think all of the autobiographies of black people that we've read on this program, I think the bulk of those black people in some way, shape, or form have pretty much confessed that they were confused about racism, that a part of the way or that they analyzed or thought about this problem was incorrect, and or this problem was far worse than what they originally thought. Like the way that they originally were conceiving of this, or yeah, maybe I thought we were under surveillance, but they did not know the breadth of the surveillance and attack that they were under. I think that pattern is in every single one of the books that we have read. So that I'm just contrasting. White people are doing experiments, studying and getting in-depth knowledge. Black people are confused about what this is and how all of this is working. That's what's happening. All the while, people keep insisting that white people are ignorant about racism. Any other folks have commentary questions?
I have one last thing. This is a female caller from Ohio. I guess the name I would go by is Red, like the color. I thought it was interesting how they, in the book, Mrs. King said that the whites in South Africa, they also had the same ideas as far as when the whites in this part of the world, in America or in the States, when they freed the slaves, they thought there was going to be this massive overload of violence, and that's how they felt when they ended apartheid, and how not only that, but they also had like an escape plan or a backup plan for the white Britons that were there. They were going to be airlifted out, so I thought that was interesting. That's all I have right now.
Great point, great point. I also, man, we've had so many great guests on from South Africa. Project Spear, Sylvia Vollenhoven. That's the documentary. It's not released, but you can go in the archives and hear her commentary. She has, I mean, fabulous information about how when exactly what we heard this week, they're celebrating and all that. That's another thing. I just found it repulsive. It reminded me Gwen Ifill, the great Emmy, her presence is here even when she's not on the line. It reminded me exactly of President Obama and black people crying, Jesse Jackson in tears, and people, oh yes, our day has come free. They mentioned Dr. King. It's exactly the same thing that just happened in South Africa. If anything, I remember Mr. Fuller said that. He said that's the example that he tried to use with President Obama, that the system of white supremacy, we've already seen this. We already know what this looks like. We can grab any Negro. We can even go grab some Negro out of prison and put them and make them president, and we still win. It doesn't matter. We already know how this works in the system of white supremacy. victims of white supremacy, we are naive. But it reminded me of that exactly. But Project Spear, Sylvia Vollenhoven, her documentary that white people would not allow. This is post-apartheid South Africa, where they would not allow her documentary to be released. And this is recent. This was 2000. She was on the program in 2013. So this was like 2012, 2013 when all of this happened. But they would not allow her to release this film, which detailed how white people, as apartheid was falling in the 90s, they literally gave out these loans. They were called lifeboats. Their loans that they gave out to all these white people when it was, the Kaffirs, they're about to take over. We'll just give out all the money from the national treasury. So they gave out all these loans to all these white people, and they never paid it back. And this was like billions. They have Rand, but I mean, just to kind of give, I guess, listeners in the States, this is billions with a B dollars in loans that they had no intention. We're just stealing this money from the South African treasury now that the Negros are going to be in charge, and then turn around and accuse them of being corrupt the whole time, what they've been doing with Jacob Zuma. But I mean, just to know all that, and to the state of things now are pretty much exactly the same, where they're protesting fees must fall and all that, roads must, all of that stuff that is still going on. Black people in the same pitiful position that they were, and events that they're talking about, the Sharpeville massacre and all of that, they contrasted that to the protests that have been happening in South Africa for about the past 2-3 years with the fees must fall, student fees being too high, and impact on black children. In fact, they mentioned Pretoria. If people remember Pretoria High School, that was the incident just a few months ago where they wouldn't allow the black children, the black female children, to wear their natural hair, because that was one of the places mentioned. I just think a lot of times we get caught up in rhetoric and titles and name dropping and things that are just not of substance. That's why I think it's so important. What you want, replace white supremacy with justice. Be very clear, explicit about what we're trying to get done. We have other commentary. I had a question, but any other commentary? Great, I'll get in my question. My question was going to be, when she says this was kind of late in chapter 19, she says, she's talking about how well Indian women were treated. They were able to hold higher, I guess, positions in politics. And she skips down. She says, I know that someday women in the United States will lead our country, not only in the highest court of the land, but at the top as president. Mrs. King passed away in 2006, so she didn't even get to see Hillary Clinton run in 2008. When she says, I know that someday women in the United States will lead our country, etc., I say consistently, when people say women, I think they mean white women. Is this one, do we think implicitly, unconsciously? Is she just talking about white women, or do we think everybody's included? Non-white, white women, that's what she's thinking, particularly in the United States context when she's talking about president, all that. Do we think this is one where she was all inclusive, everybody, non-white and white females, or was this one unconsciously she's maybe just thinking about Hillary Clinton and the rest of the white chicks?
This is Red. I definitely wholeheartedly believe that she was thinking about white women, especially like you said, and I know I asked the question before, because white women, they always seem to separate white women from females of color. So I think that she was talking about white women.
Red says white women, consciously, subconsciously?
I think probably subconsciously, because even as you were just talking about how kind of made me reconsider if she really was holding feelings against Randall and Jesse, I also started to think about like how she was, like y'all said, just name dropping and everything. And I had to look up a bunch of the people that she was naming, and one was the televangelist, and how she specifically said, and my friend, and whatever the televangelist name was, I can't get to it right now. So I think it might have been subconscious.
One for subconscious. Say that again.
I'm sorry, caller from the 712 calling with you. I agree with that caller. I think he could have been subconsciously talking about white women. Am I coming in okay?
You were a little low. I'm just making sure your volume was a little low. Say something else.
Was sorry, I had my earbuds on. I was just saying I agreed with that caller. I think, yeah, subconsciously, maybe she was.
Okay. To think maybe subconsciously. Any other folks want to respond to that?
Yeah, I agree with the previous two females. I agree subconsciously. I mean, reading over the text, she has more mention of white females in high regard than black males. I mean, black females. So it's like she has this, you know, relationship of friendships with these, you know, white females. So, but like I said, I think I agree. I think it is kind of like subconsciously.
Three thinking, perhaps subconscious. See, the caller dialed in more recently, last four digits, 5807. Did you have your own commentary, or if you wanted to answer the question, or both? 5807?
Yes, hi. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name's Margo. I believe that it was, it could have been a little bit of both as far as being conscious and unconscious. She did make the distinction when she specifically spoke of white women, and black women. So I believe that when she was speaking in the presidency, that may have been intentional, subconscious, conscious, intentional of her not mentioning just because of whatever reason in her own mind not to mention. But I believe that she really was specifically speaking of white women. I also wanted to discuss going back related to the experimentation that's done on us. They actually have a melanin conference every year or every few years that not one person of color is ever invited to. They have it in California all the time, every year or every 3 years, that not one person of color is ever invited to. So I wonder what that's about. As if we don't know.
Racists study their niggers. Absolutely. Absolutely. Did other folks have any? We are getting close to the second audio commentary, so about 3 minutes if folks have anything else. I also wanted to make sure I got in quickly as well when she says. I cut off a portion of it. I'm glad I have the e-version of this. When she says, in 1994, not a lot of activists in or out of South Africa had put as much faith in peaceful outcome as I had. But shortly after Mandela's release from prison in 1990, I heard white Afrikaners say that they expected blacks to start shooting whites, and they were shocked when this did not happen. And in another chapter of the same story, after the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves in the United States, these men, women, and children did not respond to the brutalities of their imprisonment with violence toward their former masters. That, too, is amazing. It is God's work, and it is important for me to say. This is the sort of thing where I say, now, this is just absolute folly, and it's pulling in the religion of white supremacy, Christianity. It's pulling that in to give a veneer of, you know, acceptability or credibility to all of this that is just total folly, and it's dangerous. As I understand things, they have very stringent gun laws. I've talked about before how policies change radically depending on the number of melanated folks in a given geographic region. They have tons, as the numbers were given. They have huge numbers of black people and way more black people than whites in South Africa. You do not have just willy-nilly guns everywhere and NRA lobby that is out of control and you can just go get a gun on your car. That is not South Africa. So I don't think that was an option, period. Even if black people were angry and wanted to get at white people, they didn't have the muscle
to go get at white people, even though they greatly outnumbered them, which further exemplifies, illustrates what white power is. Here, the U.S. model, same thing, although here, since it's a lot less black people, they were greatly outnumbered by the racists, and the same thing. They had specific laws to make sure that black people didn't have weapons. I've referenced this repeatedly. In my home state of Virginia, before there was a United States, they had laws forbidding black people to have firearms. They had these laws on the books, and I guess it'd be the colony of Virginia in the 17th century, 1600s. They do not allow black people to have weapons. So black people are generally not in position in the system of white supremacy to respond with that sort of violence, even if they wanted to, not because, you know, God made black people so mild and humble and forgiving. That is just absurd. And as I said before, if we're going to brag about being nonviolent and forgiving, it should be being nonviolent and forgiving with other black people, not racists. Unless anybody has something they can get in like 2 minutes.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to make a note on that, too. Several of the white people that have come on your show even talked about that in the books that they wrote, about how white people do not have a fear of the number differences related to that. So it has to be more than that. I mean, they basically openly say that we're not really worried about the numbers. We already know that black people outnumber us, and they're not worried about that. Those are not their worries. They worry about the power piece. That is the main worry, is the power piece. That's why they orchestrate things the way they do. So we don't have guns. We don't have an orchestrate law, so we don't have access to them. So it's something that's known. I mean, they know this.
Absolutely.
And Gus, just real quick, this caller from the 712, if they did go and do all of that shooting, I mean, they were like under horrible conditions, apartheid with the white people that was over. If they did do all of that shooting, you know, could you really blame them? I don't want to see violence. Nobody wants to see violence. But I'm just saying, if they did hop up there and get the guns and snapped when it was all over, what could you really say? Look what they were living under. I mean, my line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been my experience. I would have a much more difficult time thinking of examples when white people brag about being nonviolent with non-white people. Like, I can think of a lot of different situations, times where black people are encouraged or celebrated for being nonviolent with white people. I cannot, generally speaking, think of examples where white people brag about and celebrate being nonviolent with other non-white people. In fact, white people generally celebrate and make monuments about the times that they brutalized and bombed other non-white people. That's been my experience. Make movies about it and celebrate it and what have you. Anywho, we will get to the second audio segment. We're picking up, I believe this is chapter 20, about how they established the King holiday as a federal holiday. Yep. Chapter 20, Happy Birthday, Martin. Context of White Supremacy, Coretta Scott King's autobiography, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, audio segment number 2.
20. Happy Birthday, Martin. As you might have noticed by now, I can be a very determined woman. When I put my mind to something with hard work and God's grace, it has usually come to pass. Perhaps nowhere has this process been more obvious and more useful that in my efforts to establish Martin's birthday as a national holiday, observed now in all 50 states and also in more than 100 nations. Only a few close friends and religious leaders believed this holiday would ever happen, but I never really doubted it. I understood that sometimes a hard task simply requires that one person is particularly chosen to hear the charge, the divine calling, and to step out on faith. The people, the resources, the strategy will follow. That's what happened with me and the King Holiday. At the heart of things, we who believed in the King Holiday had to have a vision. We also had to attract the best minds and map out a blueprint. The vision and the planning took time and training. Many of the skills I used were ones I'd never even thought of developing until I had to use them. I learned how to lobby members of Congress. I organized a coalition of 750 political, religious, labor, and civil rights groups. I also had to experience failure, or results that were less than my expectations, and this failure taught me more about winning than many of the ventures I had previously labeled a success. Often, when writers or commentators speak about the holiday, it is said in a short sentence or a fleeting breath. There's no depth to it, no recognition of the hard work and the miracles it took for the holiday to come into being, no attempt to fully convey or do justice to the process or the thousands of people around the world who directly involved themselves, providing their time, talent, and funds to help. Nor does any mention of the holiday properly demonstrate how God can use anybody to accomplish the most impossible feats. God certainly used me. John Conyers, a Democratic congressman from Michigan, first introduced a bill to establish Martin's January 15th birthday as a federal holiday in April 1968, just 4 days after Martin was assassinated. But the road to achieving passage of that bill was 15 long and winding years, and there were a lot of twists and turns in the road. I have always had a burning desire to alleviate poverty through good jobs, and by the mid-1970s, the double-digit unemployment rates among blacks, Hispanics, and the residents of Appalachia were worrying me deeply. In 1974, I helped develop and co-chaired the National Committee for Full Employment with Murray Finley, president of the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union, ACTWU. Our goal was to pass comprehensive legislation to address employment opportunity that, if enacted, we hoped would be as far-reaching as the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Even though in the end our committee won fewer battles than we expected, the fight for full employment moved me inside the complex system of legislating. I saw how laws are made, and even more important, how good laws are broken and ignored. I was able to operate in a different way from Martin, who achieved victories as an outsider, applying pressure on the inside power brokers. Times had changed. The movement had opened the doors to us. We had more legislators on the inside who were sympathetic to our causes. Still, I had to learn which doors to go through and how to properly use the influence I possessed. The drive for full employment was the bridge that brought me to an understanding about the art of lobbying. To be successful, we had to build strong coalitions. And I began to see that one of my strengths was as a coalition builder. My work fighting for full employment deeply convinced me that jobs that pay fair wages are an answer to many of the social and economic problems that afflict so many nations. Unemployment is often blamed solely on individuals who are depicted as too lazy to work. In reality, the bulk of the problem is global and involves the tax breaks and low wages that entice nations, such as ours, to move corporations offshore and overseas and to exploit cheap labor in Asia, for example. On the line are the lives of decent, hardworking people who want to cross over into the dignity of work, but who remain caught in the barbed wire trap of historic global exploitation. Whenever I could bring the issue of unemployment into a debate or a panel discussion, I was not timid about addressing it. Following on my work with the National Committee for Full Employment, I was also co-chair of the Full Employment Action Council, and in 1977, that council organized Full Employment Week, a national demonstration for jobs involving more than 1 million people in more than 300 cities and towns. As it happened, a bill addressing the necessity for full employment was making its way through Congress in 1977. Representative Augustus Hawkins, a Democratic congressman from California, had offered what became known as the Humphrey-Hawkins Bill after Senator Hubert Humphrey co-sponsored it. Once I understood that this bill was already in the works, our mission became to support it. Murray Finley and I brought a lot of labor on board. We spoke to labor unions and at rallies, meetings, and conventions, trying to educate people about the need for full employment. We traveled all across the country. On these travels, whenever I talked to the average person, especially students, I never felt that there was a lot of excitement surrounding the employment bill, yet when I added that we should have a holiday in honor of Martin's birthday, I would always get loud applause. My first mission was to make people understand that unemployment was a pressing issue that needed national attention, but I sort of tucked away that response about the birthday holiday for a later time. I began to feel that there were strong national feelings in favor of the holiday. As I tried to promote the full employment bill, I kept saying to my speechwriters, look, we've got to use the kind of language that's going to reach people and get them excited, get them disturbed. We tried to paint a vivid picture of what unemployment was doing to families and so on, but it felt too much like an intellectual argument, and that worried me. Still, I stayed with my assignment. I wanted so deeply to help bring down poverty rates that I didn't want to drop the ball. The Full Employment Action Council determined that the correct measure for full employment would be around 3%, which was considered negligible. This was the guiding formula we used for making our argument. From the start, critics claimed that we were coming up with another welfare plan, so we immediately had to disprove a negative and demonstrate that our plan was not welfare. We were also hampered by the fact that we did not have the financial resources of the Business Roundtable, a group that was lobbying against the bill. In the end, the Humphrey Hawkins Full Employment Act did pass, and Jimmy Carter signed it into law on October 27, 1978, though by the time it passed, it was too watered down to make much of an impact. First, there was the language of the bill, which called for the impeachment of a president if certain measures were not achieved. Well, nobody was going to do that. Maybe that's why Congress passed it. They knew it would not be taken seriously. And second, while our good friend President Carter supported the bill, he was lukewarm about it. He could see businesses did not want it, and he needed their support. In addition, the president had the responsibility of implementing the bill, yet most of the jobs it affected were in the private sector. This was something no president could directly implement or enforce. The act set specific numerical goals for the president to achieve. It stated that by 1983, unemployment rates should be no more than 3% per persons aged 20 or over, and no more than 4% for persons aged 16 or over, and inflation rates should not be over 4%. By 1988, inflation rates should be 0%. The act allowed Congress to revise these goals over time. If private enterprise appeared to be falling short of its goals, the act expressly allowed the government to create a reservoir of public employment. These jobs are required to be in the lower ranges of skill and pay to minimize competition with the private sector. With unemployment continuing to run in the steady double digits in communities of color, it is sad that the major provisions of the Humphrey Hawkins Act were not amended. Instead, they were put on a shelf and ignored. I can only imagine how many lives would have been changed or saved if the bill had been taken seriously. Joblessness contributes significantly to the cradle-to-prison pipeline, to inadequate access to health care, to mental illness, and to hopelessness, which is a major factor in violent crime. U.S. service sector jobs are steadily disappearing. Customer service jobs, for example, have been exported to the Philippines, India, and Jamaica. Or, in the case of supermarket checkout workers, for example, these jobs have been displaced by scanners or other forms of technology. Yet, while the working and middle-class workers suffer, the wealthiest Americans have gotten much richer. The Humphrey Hawkins Act, which expired in 2000, might have created a 21st-century New Deal, gainfully employing unemployed Americans to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure and strengthen our communities. In the end, I had to make peace with the bill being less than satisfying, but I found comfort in remembering how Martin dealt with such things. When you achieve a minor victory, you have to take it and make it more of a major victory. He showed me this during the Democratic National Convention in 1964, when Fannie Lou Hamer led the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenge at the convention. Her small but mighty group asked that the old Democratic Party be unseated and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party be seated in its place, as it was more representative of the people. Martin was a negotiator for the Freedom Party, but that year they could only get about 2 or 3 people seated. The SNCC then attacked Martin as an Uncle Tom, blaming him for the slow progress. I remember how Martin agonized over this situation and how the press was asking him all these questions, and in response he said, "You know, we didn't all get what we wanted, but I consider it a victory, and I will continue to work at it. In the next 4 years, perhaps we will get all of those seats." He felt that if we went back home and told our people that we'd lost, they wouldn't follow us anymore. I learned from watching Martin's work, and I tried to help other people see that while we didn't get all we wanted in our efforts toward full employment, all was not lost. We did gain something, and that was the way we had to look at it. "People need a sense of hope so that they can keep on struggling," Martin would tell me. So after the Humphrey Hawkins Act turned out to be less than I had hoped for, I said to myself, maybe we didn't get all we wanted. But we need to keep mobilizing. Maybe someday we can get a stronger bill. When you're doing something significant, and you are even moderately successful, you need to promote it in such a way that people understand what you're doing and what you've accomplished. If you don't, people will think you haven't done anything. When you promote what you've done, you can then try to understand how to improve upon what you did get. When the Humphrey Hawkins bill passed, we should have created an apparatus to monitor its application, but we didn't have the resources, so nobody really understood what had happened or how to provide proper follow-up or constant vigilance. Despite these challenges with Humphrey Hawkins, I did not come out of that 4-year experience bitter, and the experience of learning how to pass a bill was vital for me. I had made many friends in Congress, and I had heard, could still hear, the roar of the masses calling for a Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. So I turned to our good friend, Representative John Conyers, still a Democratic congressman from Michigan in the 1970s, just as he had been in the 1960s. John Conyers was a real hero in the effort to honor Martin's life and legacy with a national holiday. Year after year after year, ever since Martin died, John, who was also one of the 13 founding members of the Congressional Black Caucus, persisted in introducing the same King birthday bill over and over. In all, Congress rejected the bill more than 70 times. Then, in 1979, following on my decade of speeches about the birthday in every state of the Union, I said to John, "It's time to bring the King holiday bill to vote on the House floor again." It was obvious to me that the masses were calling for the King holiday. Some around me hesitated, though, afraid we still did not have enough congressional support. My response was, "You know better than that. If we hadn't had a small but effective coalition on the inside, we never would have passed Humphrey Hawkins. There, the cards were stacked against us. Here, I believe there's enough sentiment among the people to help us get this bill passed." John also felt the passion building. He was ready to bring the bill to the floor again. He asked me to come to Washington to meet Tip O'Neill, the Democratic Speaker of the House, and with Senator Robert Byrd, the Democratic Senate Majority Leader from West Virginia. Only a few short years before, I would have been anxious about meeting with Byrd. It was common knowledge that he'd been an active member of the KKK and that he'd filibustered the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. But while I was campaigning for Humphrey Hawkins, I'd had a chance to meet with him, and he had assured me that his views had changed. During the 1979 visit to Washington, I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee and spoke with passion about the bill's importance and about how I wanted the holiday to be on the actual date of Martin's birthday. O'Neill and Byrd agreed to go forward with this plan. I went back to Atlanta. But several weeks later, John called me back to Washington to do more lobbying, to call on more congresspersons, and to testify before a joint hearing of Congress. The leadership agreed to use a rule that required 2/3 vote on the bill for it to pass, instead of a simple majority. Because of that rule change, and because some of the stronger supporters were absent when the bill came to the floor, we lost by about 5 votes in the House. Nevertheless, I vowed to keep pushing with the same resolve and faith that I was putting into building the King Center. In order for a national holiday to have meaning, it had to be embraced by all 50 states. Just the thought of how officials in some southern and western states regarded my husband was enough to rock the confidence of even my closest friends. As a matter of fact, even Andy Young said, "Do you really believe we're going to get a holiday?" "Yes, we will," I said firmly. Every year since 1969, the King Center has celebrated Martin's life and legacy with week-long festivities and awards that begin on his birthday, January 15. As the years passed, the center became the de facto hub of a national holiday celebration. Each year, increasing numbers of Americans and even visitors from foreign countries made a pilgrimage to the center for the birthday week. Across the nation, thousands of governmental agencies, federal, state, and city, businesses, communities, and church groups had also begun celebrating King Week. Although many honored Martin with sincerity and dignity, others failed to capture his spirit or ideology, or they dishonored him with crass commercialization. To achieve some type of decorum and uniformity, the King Center Board had to issue a standards of conduct for honoring Martin, calling on groups not to exploit Dr. King's name or good work for financial, political, or other selfish gain, to commit to nonviolence, and to agree that any fundraising activities designed to continue the work of Dr. King must first address the needs of the only living memorial, namely the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change. Meanwhile, year after year, I undertook a letter-writing campaign, reaching out to mayors, state legislators, and governors across the nation, asking them to observe my husband's birthday as an annual holiday. In 1971, the SCLC had gathered 3 million pro-holiday signatures, though those weren't enough to sway Congress. In 1973, the state of Illinois became the first state to sign the King holiday into state law. This bill was sponsored by Assemblyman Harold Washington, who later became Chicago's first African-American mayor. In 1979, we launched a new petition drive, which ultimately resulted in 6 million signatures. In 1980, I testified again before the House and the Senate. Also that year, Stevie Wonder released Happy Birthday, a song celebrating Martin and advocating for the holiday. In 1982, I testified again before Senate and House committees, and Stevie Wonder and I presented the petitions carrying those 6 million signatures to House Speaker Tip O'Neill and bill floor manager Representative Robert Garcia of New York in special ceremonies at the U.S. Capitol. While all this work was going on, a miracle was coming in the form of the 20th anniversary of the March on Washington and Martin's I Have a Dream speech on August 27, 1983. In December 1982, on the White House lawn, I announced the creation of a new Coalition of Conscience, a group of organizations to help sponsor the 20th anniversary of the march. By that summer, there were 750 organizations in that group, and at the top of the group's legislative agenda was the King Holiday Bill. Washington felt a groundswell coming. In June 1983, I testified once again before Congress on behalf of the King Holiday Bill. And in July, first-term Congresswoman Katie Hall, Democrat from Indiana, reintroduced the holiday bill, co-sponsored by Jack Kemp, Republican from New York. On August 2, 1983, the House voted 338-90 in favor of designating the third Monday in January as the day to honor Martin. Sensing the mounting support for the bill, Senate Majority Leader Howard Baker, Republican from Tennessee, sent the House version to the Senate floor without committee review. A few weeks later, the 20th anniversary of the March on Washington firmly demonstrated just how much people cared about a holiday for Martin. Stevie Wonder again sang Happy Birthday, which had become a rallying cry across America and was on the lips of marchers who showed up 500,000 strong at the Lincoln Memorial. The efforts we had begun in 1969 had finally reached the tipping point. Yet even as the bill was gaining traction, Republican Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina staged a filibuster against it. On October 3, 1983, Helms read a paper on the Senate floor entitled Martin Luther King Jr., Political Activities and Associations, and provided a 300-page supplemental document to members of the Senate detailing my husband's so-called communist connections. Some senators expressed outrage over Helms' actions, including New York's Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who threw the document to the ground, stomped on it, and deemed it a packet of filth. Helms argued that any person opposed to a King holiday would automatically be dubbed a racist, and urged the Senate not to be bullied into elevating my husband to the same level as the father of our country and above the many other Americans whose achievements approached that of George Washington's by making him one of the few individuals honored by a federal holiday. He mounted a campaign to amend the birthday bill so that the holiday would be named National Civil Rights Day, would include no mention of Martin, and would fall on a Sunday when most Americans were already off from work. Fortunately, Helms' efforts were unsuccessful, and the bill went to the Senate for a vote. On October 19, 1983, with all members present, the Senate voted 78-22 to make my husband's birthday a national holiday. The Senate bill was co-sponsored by Senator Ted Kennedy. After 15 years of lobbying, 9 million petition signatures, hundreds of thousands of marching feet, telegrams from around the world, outreach from President Jimmy Carter and Pope John Paul II, the Martin Luther King Jr. birthday holiday was finally a federal law. The bill represented the first time a national holiday was established for someone other than a U.S. president or Christopher Columbus, who is credited as well as discredited as the first European to discover America. The bill, known as H.R. 3706, was the 10th federal holiday established by Congress. On November 3, 1983, I, along with my children, Edith, Christine, and other members of our family and leaders of the civil rights movement my husband led, crowded into the Rose Garden. Vice President George H.W. Bush was there, along with Representatives Katie Hall and Jack Kemp, Senators Howard Baker and Ted Kennedy, Senator Bob Dole, Republican from Kansas, and Samuel Pierce, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. There we witnessed the signing of the King Holiday Bill into law by President Ronald Reagan. Martin's holiday would be celebrated on the third Monday in January, beginning in 1986. President Reagan was cordial during the ceremonies and displayed no angst to those of us gathered there, though he had opposed the bill until it was passed by Congress. Then, with a stroke of his pen, the holiday was finally law. However, national holidays are legal holidays only for federal employees and the District of Columbia. To make it truly a national holiday, our work was still cut out for us. In preparation for the holiday's inauguration, we had to visit 50 states and 42 cities, ensuring that each local government was correctly informed about the launch. Having learned from the Humphrey Hawkins aftermath, we called for Congress to establish a federal commission to oversee how the holiday was institutionalized and to create some uniformity in how it was celebrated across the country. Congress passed that legislation, which President Reagan signed into law on August 27, 1984. I became a life member of the commission and its first and only chairperson. Lloyd Davis, a former HUD official and executive director of the King Center, was the commission's first and only executive director. Initially, the commission was slated to last for 5 years, but Congress twice extended its life and it formally ended its mission in 1996. With the federal holiday now in effect for more than a decade, it's easy to forget how difficult a task it was to accomplish. Just imagine someone locked in a tiny prison for 15 years, handcuffed and shackled to the floor, able to peep out of only a small crack in the wall. His cries are unheard by the people walking by, except for one woman. She makes faithful daily trips to the prison. With each visit, she beats on the crack in the wall. One day, the wall breaks into splinters, and she sees that there's not just one prisoner, but many who broke free. You might say I was the woman who kept beating on the wall. It was a labor of love, a long, hard labor. When the commission began its work in 1984, only 27 states and Washington, D.C. observed Martin's birthday in some manner. Arizona was infamously resistant. All three House Republicans, including U.S. Senator John McCain, voted against the bill in 1983. Arizona did not vote in favor of recognizing the holiday until 1992, after the NFL moved Super Bowl XXVII from Tempe's Sun Devil Stadium to San Diego, California, in protest over Arizona's resistance to the holiday. While one of the most recalcitrant, Arizona was not the only state openly contemptuous of federal law. In 2000, 17 years after the law's official passage, South Carolina became the last state to sign a bill recognizing Martin Luther King Jr. Day as a paid holiday. By then, in all U.S. territories and at all U.S. installations around the world, Martin's birthday was observed as a national holiday, and more than 100 other nations celebrated it as well. With the bill signed, and with support for the holiday encircling the globe, I searched for proper words to express the joy I felt. The statement I released at the time captures it. As a nation chooses its heroes and heroines, a nation interprets its history and shapes its destiny. If the achievements of the King Center's local, national, and international programs and the global influence of the King birthday holiday ever gave the impression that racism had somehow disappeared since my husband's death, some events in January 1987 were a chilling reminder that Atlanta was still in Georgia, and that Georgia was still in the South, and that the South, as well as the United States, had much further to go toward freedom. That January, as we prepared to observe the second annual federal holiday, as well as National King Week in Atlanta, Reverend Hosea Williams, then an Atlanta City Councilman, was invited by Dean Carter, a white karate instructor from Forsyth County, to commemorate the King holiday by participating in a Brotherhood March into Forsyth, an all-white county in Georgia. On January 17th, a busload of about 80 African Americans led by Reverend Williams arrived in Cumming, Georgia, the county seat of Forsyth, to join Carter. Almost immediately, the marchers were attacked and beaten by a group of white segregation proponents. Reverend Wilson was hit by a rock, and this was shown on the news. The incident drew national attention, and Reverend Williams and Dean Carter vowed to return on January 24th to continue the march. I immediately offered my support, and with the King Center as a base of action, I got on the phone and mobilized a team. One of my first calls was to James Orange, who had been an important ground crew organizer for my husband and a staffer at SCLC. He, along with other civil rights grassroots leaders, helped me organize a massive turnout to support Hosea Williams and Dean Carter's return to Forsyth County. Andrew Young and Reverend Joseph Lowry also helped. This was a national mobilization against fear and intimidation. As the day neared, it became clear that the number of people joining us for the march would exceed our expectations. Therefore, we had to add quickly 75 more buses to the 100 we already reserved. People arrived from all across the country, including civil rights leaders, college presidents, U.S. senators, and other elected officials. On June 24th, I, along with several family members, King Center board members, staff, elected officials, and community activists, gathered at the center to board the 175 buses and other vehicles to transport us to Cumming. As the number of arriving people continued to swell, we realized that even the buses we had reserved would not be enough to accommodate the overflow. Several thousand marchers were left behind to find their own way to Forsyth. On top of that, there were 4 to 6 inches of snow on the ground. The Georgia FBI unit, along with 1,700 National Guard troops, provided security. William Bradford Reynolds, Assistant U.S. General Attorney, flew from Washington to join the march. Members of the Guardian Angels also took part. But right-wing activists also showed up in force. J.B. Stoner, the infamous white supremacist, was on hand signing autographs. Former Georgia Governor Lester Maddox mingled with about 500 white counter-protesters who waved Confederate flags and shouted insults at the marchers. Klan members showed up wearing Klan robes. My daughter Bernice recalls that our bus passed a spot where the counter-protesters had written, "Go home, Niger," in the snow. We were pleased that with just 7 days to mobilize, more than 20,000 of us were able to converge on Forsyth County to stand up for justice and equality. In the wake of our march, Oprah Winfrey arranged to broadcast her daily TV show from Cummings, the first time she aired a show away from her home base in Chicago. Despite the violence that had greeted the marches on the 17th, this incident was also a reminder of how much things had changed and of the vital roles the civil rights movement, the King Center, and the King Holiday had played in advancing race relations in the South. An abundance of whites joined us for the January 24 march, and the law was on our side.
Needed an extra second to get my headset together. That is the end of the second segment. Actually, that is the end of the second audio segment, and that is the end of the 20th chapter. We'll pick up there next week for the conclusion. Actually, we did not finish the chapter 20. There's a little bit left, so we'll finish. I think it's like five, six pages. For the rest of chapter 20, we'll pick up next week. And closing in, I think we probably have maybe four sessions left and we'll be done. If you have commentary you would like to share on the audio segment we just heard, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in, who have a hand up, the line should be open. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. Folks who dialed in who have a hand up, did you all have commentary or nothing to say from the second audio segment?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to note that I noticed that she had a laundry list of all the white leaders, racist or non-racist, that were there that she outlined. Which I thought was kind of interesting to know all of them.
Absolutely. Was that all you were going to add, ma'am?
I mean, as far as the holiday goes, it just reminded me of when Harriet Tubman was put on the $20 bill. It made people seem like we arrived somehow or whatever. And we still have a long way to go, and just getting a holiday or even the $20 is just a way to placate the situation to me, while unemployment is still rampant in rampant numbers in our communities. Gentrification is happening all over the country in major cities. Just so many different things that speak in opposition of what they try to portray to make it seem, or to make many of us, I guess, not fight the good fight, to think that, you know, we can stop now, or we've arrived or whatever. And I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Margot. Any of the other folks who dialed in with a hand up, did you all have commentary? Any of the other folks that are with us have commentary for the second audio? See, the switchboard is not doing correctly. Oh, okay, there we go. The caller at 4243, you should be with us as well.
Hey, this is Red again. The commentary that I have for this segment, I noticed that she used the word fair when referring to the Humphrey Hawkins bill. She said, my work fighting for full employment deeply convinced me that jobs that pay fair wages are an answer to many of the social and economic problems. So I just thought that that was interesting because I know that I have been, since listening to the show, trying to monitor my use of the word fair. One thing that I had kind of like I was kind of confused about was also when she was referring to the Humphrey Hawkins bill, how she said on her travels, whenever she talked to the average person, especially students, I didn't quite understand that. It seemed like a little bit disparaging, I guess, but I could be confused about that. She did also mention, again, how good friend she was with President Carter when I thought that there were, when she needed, I feel like in previous chapters when she was going back to him to get funds for maybe like the King Center or some committee or what have you that she was trying to get money for, he turned her down or he just ignored her. The other thing was how she kept referencing that the bill was not necessarily what it was supposed to have been after it had been watered down, or like the details of it were just so, I guess, ridiculous. I can't think of another word to describe it, but the details of it were so ridiculous that there was no way of it actually being enforced, which makes it seem like other people have said that whites will pass something or they will almost give you something and really give you nothing. They pass this bill in basically making non-whites believe that they are going to, or hope that they are going to get, as she put, a fair wage or a just wage, or even get a chance to have employment. And there was no actual, they had no intention of enforcing this law. The other thing, throughout this whole chapter, it was kind of bewildering to me how much people really fought for the holiday. I have nothing bad to say about the holiday, but it kind of makes me think about if Dr. King would have really wanted all this energy to go into having a holiday in his name. Especially when Mrs. King references in the beginning, in the earlier part of the book, where he didn't want a fancy house. He didn't really want a bunch of nice clothing or anything like that. But then there's a lot of energy going into this bill. I definitely thought it was interesting when they brought up foresight, because I remember there was a guest on the show, and I feel like he was from Foresight, or he did a story about Foresight. And you definitely correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that was one of the places where, of course, they ran out all the black residents. And I thought they used their, the headstones that they had in the black cemetery, I thought they used those headstones to, like, line, like, for their sidewalks and for their stoops. I could be mistaken about that, but I do definitely remember a white man being on the show talking about just the racism in Forsyth, so it didn't really surprise me, just the treatment that they had. And another thing that I was really confused about was just I don't know if it's a metaphor, an analogy that she said as far as when she told a story about a woman going to visit a prisoner, and she would keep kind of beating on the wall because there was a crack until finally the wall broke. Until it says one day the wall breaks into splinters and she sees that there was not just one prisoner, but many who broke free. I'm not quite sure about the many who broke free part. That's all I have for now. Thank you.
Wowee. Music to Gus's ears. that was Patrick Phillips, Blood at the Root. The white author who, and you nailed them both, not only did he write a book about Forsyth County and the black people being purged, F to Gus T. Renegade. I always emphasize that, how often these racial purges of black residents have happened, more than 250 times. But that should have been mentioned when talking about Forsyth, that this is a notorious area, to leave that out. And again, you have Reverend Dr. Barbara Reynolds. That's an important bit of history that needs to be included. Patrick Phillips' book, again, it just came out at the end of 2016, Blood at the Root. And he was born in that area, so he talks about his own childhood. He also was at that march, the first one, not the one that Coretta Scott King was at, but he was at that first march where they got pelted and called nigger and everything else, and then they went back the second time around. But he was there, and so he talks about that in the book as well. And absolutely, you nailed it. They used the tombstones from the black cemetery as sidewalks. Those details are included in Patrick Phillips' book, and we talked about that specifically on the program when he visited with us. If memory is correct, I think that was September of 2016. Also, wanted to make sure that I got in Gil Scott Heron. His book, The Last Holiday, is very good, and the main point of the book is about his efforts also to help get the King holiday. He talks about, you know, Stevie Wonder's efforts and what have you. It's also kind of a half autobiography of his own life. So he's kind of weaving in and out of his own childhood and growing up and that sort of thing, and then what he was doing with trying to help get the King holiday. Did other folks have commentary that they wanted to share? Ma'am, are you there? You want to speak up one more time? I don't know if you're adjusting your headset or getting your audio straight, but I could hear you. Oh, are you still with us, or did you have to? Maybe she'll hang up and dial back in. I'll look out for you if you hang up and dial back in. Other folks, if you have commentary, I'll get out a few of the notes that I took from this chapter. When she talks about this Humphrey Hawkins Full Employment Act, it's my view that's what I mean about rhetoric. When I said that before, well, you can have a lot of highfalutin, nice sounding words, but when it comes to application, there's nothing there. Either the things that are being said, exactly what it says here, the act did pass and Jimmy Carter signed it into law on October 27th, though by the time it passed, it was too watered down to make much of an impact. First, there was the language in the bill which called for the impeachment of the president if certain measures were not achieved. Well, nobody was going to do that. Maybe that's why Congress passed it. They knew it would not be taken seriously. That right there, white people, and particularly in conversations on racism, that's why I talk about metaphors a lot of times, either directly, indirectly, a lot of times people in racism say things where it's not something that you can be taken seriously. It's not something that can be applied literally. And that's what we need, literal mechanics to solving our problems and stopping whites from being able to practice racism against black people. That's what we need, not holidays and monuments and all this other stuff. Because the system can give you a lot of those things and still maintain domination and terrorism over black people. Let's see, what else did I have? Harold Washington, we talked about it, folks, remember from last year when we read Leonida McLean's A Foot in Each World, a black Chicago journalist. She talked in detail about Harold Washington's campaign to become the first black mayor of Chicago and the amount of white terrorism that he experienced and she experienced as well as a black Chicago native covering everything. But yeah, she talked about that. And I think she talked about the King Bill and some of the resistance to that as well. I'll have to see if I can gander in my library really quick. Let's see. Jesse Helms, the legend, his opposition. I think Jerry Falwell was another one. I think CNN, they have some great archives of some of the whites who came out and publicly went on record and just had all kinds of vile things to say about Dr. King. And, oh, he was a nasty communist and he cheated on his wife and all this. I mean, it just went. And again, this is not ancient history. This is from like the 80s. This is not that long ago. Let's see. Arizona, I thought that was great that she included that. Senator John McCain being one of the white Arizonans who were in opposition. I think they were staunch. Remember, folks were called Public Enemy, did that song By the Time I Get to Arizona, talking about their resistance to the King holiday. That's something that I brought up in other incidents of racism, white supremacy. I think we've even had Reverend Jared Maupin. He's an Arizona native. He's been on the program, and he talked about that specifically, living through and seeing some of those very whites who opposed the King holiday. They're still at office or still hanging out, still practicing and racism, presumably. The great Dylan Storm Roof, when people act, I can't believe this happened in South Carolina. I thought that was great to include that South Carolina became the last state to sign a bill recognizing the Martin Luther King Jr. Day as a paid holiday. That this was in 2000. Again, not ancient history. I always appreciate that sort of detail. And one more thing I wanted to get in, and then I'll double check and see if folks had any additional comments. That portion at the end, where she's talking about the march in Forsyth County. I started with the sound clip from Oprah Winfrey's segment where she went down there to talk to some of the residents, and you heard some of what they had to say. That portion at the end, very Pollyanna, the rhetoric, where she says, despite the violence that had greeted the marchers on the 17th, this incident was also a reminder of how much things had changed and of the vital roles the civil rights movement, the King Center, and the King holiday had played in advancing race relations in the South. An abundance of whites joined us for the January 24th march, and the law was on our side. There were still no black people living in Forsyth County after they left. And even today, I think the number of black people in Forsyth County is, I mean, it's like way low, like lower than, way lower than 10%, way lower than that. I think it's even way lower than 5%. And there's still, this was land theft in Forsyth County. There was no compensation for the black residents who were forced out at gunpoint and just had their property stolen from them. We also talked about this with Elliot Jasmine, Buried in the Bitter Water. He talked about Forsyth County extensively and many other regions where the same thing happened. But that's what I mean when we have this just really flowery rhetoric about how much, and the language, reconciliation, advancing race relations. What does that mean? Either you have a system of white supremacy or you don't. Just the language in this, particularly in the second half of this book, is not something that accurately conveys the system of white supremacy. This to me, like I said, it just to me seems like name dropping about the importance of the King Center and her husband's work. Great what he did, but we're trying to solve a problem. And I think Dr. King would co-sign on that from what I know about his work. We're not trying to glorify himself or any other black people who've been working against racism. We're just trying to solve the problem. And maybe we can, you know, make time for all that stuff after this problem has been taken care of, because whites can do and frequently do a phenomenal job sidetracking us with this sort of thing, and or confusing us into thinking that if we get this black person elected, or if we get this center, we get this bill passed, that that's the end goal. Not at all. Replace white supremacy with justice. Did other folks have commentary? The caller that I guess got bumped off, maybe, were you able to dial back in? Not seeing other hands. If you dialed back in, you might need to press *61. Again, to raise your hand if you have commentary. I did see other folks dialed in, but I don't see hands, so I don't know if you have commentary to get in or not. We'll give it another second or so. Okay, there we go. There's one. Do you have commentary you want to get in? I'll
didn't quite understand it, but it sounded something. I don't know if you're at work or if you're just in a spot where you're not able to talk, but we should have 5 minutes or so left in the program. So if you're able, I guess if you're situated, if you're able to get to a spot where you can share your thoughts, I'll check back before we conclude the broadcast. Anything else folks wanted to make sure that they got in, the other folks that had a hand up?
Hello, this is Fred again. Just referring back to that Humphrey-Hawkins bill or Hawkins-Humphrey bill, it just to correlate it with like current events, it made me think about the Sandra Bland bill, how when they first, like especially like with Mrs. King and like her committees, and I thought it seems like she has set up so many different committees and commissions and stuff like that throughout the second half of the book. But how they started out having so many different parts of the bill, and then once in, like, in her words, you said it got watered down, and I feel like that's exactly what they did with the Sandra Bland bill, how it was supposed to have all these different things to protect people, to protect, of course, non-white people, and once it got, quote-unquote, passed, then it was watered down and basically a shell of what it was supposed to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That sort of thing is common, very common, particularly with anything that is supposed to aid or assist black people. Either it's no way that it can be enforced, not something that's going to be taken seriously, regular tactic for the racists. Let's see. Didn't see other hands. While I'm sharing, we will be here tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, for the compensatory call-in. We'll also be here on Sunday, Global Sunday Talk on Racism. That'll be the early broadcast to accommodate folks different parts of the world, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. And Pam should be with us next week, next Wednesday to be specific, and there will be no further reschedule. She says she is blanking the calendar, so if she reschedules on us again, we will make a field trip to Chicago and let her know what is up. But those broadcasts upcoming for the week, and as I said, we should have about four sessions left in this text before we go. I do still learn. I've said that before. I said that with Gwen Ifill, for folks who, you know, I've been I guess not as pleased with the reading portion that we've done this week, the last 2 weeks, no indictment of Felicia Rashad or even Coretta Scott King, just victims of white supremacy trying to solve the problem, and given my view on what we've read. But I do think it's important. Reading still very important, and I still learn, even if it's a book like this or like Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough, which was also not on my top five list of favorite books, but I do still learn a lot. And they're talking about so many, you know, real world events that do have importance and things that happened that are significant. I think it's always good to learn. I know I've learned quite a bit, a lot of things that I did not know when we started reading this book that I've picked up since we've been reading, and looking forward to finishing it up over the next 3 to 4 weeks. The female caller who was kind of getting situated, did you need more time? Or are you able to share? She might still be getting herself situated. I will assume she's still situated. Got probably about another 2 minutes because we are winding down in the broadcast. I had been saying read, maybe for the book club, that we should read Gil Scott Heron's The Last Holiday. This is a book I read like the first half of it, and I got distracted. This was, I think, back in 2013. In fact, I think it was Minister of Information J.R. Valray, Block Report Radio. He was a guest on the program in the summer of 2013, and this was one of the books that he recommended, Gil Scott Heron's autobiography. And it is really good. I remember like just enjoying it for the summer that I was reading it. But I also think it's something that might be good to read on the program. He, in the preface to the book, he says, "I'm grateful to dozens of people who helped advance my work over the years and who helped further the accomplishment I am trying to describe here. I hope that will become clear in the descriptions that follow. In the meantime, I would hope this book helps all of us to remember to celebrate Brother Stevie Wonder on his own birthday and on January 15th, the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr., every year. As I said, he weaves in and out of his work for the Dr. King holiday, as well as his own childhood growing up, and how he became a poet, musician. Revolution will not be televised. Gil Scott Heron. Checking in again. Female caller, did you need a mother? Another second or two? Are
Hi.
You good?
Hey, everybody. Can you hear me
yes,
okay?
Ma'am. Crystal clear.
Okay. All right. With the King holiday, if it's a holiday, the schools are usually closed. Is that right?
In some instances, they are.
Okay. Because I don't think we get it in Iowa. They, I mean, you can call your child out of school and tell them that they won't be coming because it's MLK Day. But they don't do anything like shutting down schools. Banks are closed, and there's no post delivered. But they don't do it here in Nebraska either. And I just want to get that in. And then you were talking about John McCain too, and I know he was the last person to say, okay, we'll go ahead and do it in Arizona. So. Yeah, this is a real good read because I didn't know Happy Birthday was written for Martin Luther King Jr. I thought it was just a happy birthday song that he wrote. So that's great. That was good information, too. And thanks for waiting on me so I can comment. I appreciate that. I'll mute my line.
For sure. We do what we can. Yeah, that's what I said. I always learn. Even it's very rare that there will be a book that I don't like and I don't learn anything. It's very difficult. I'm a victim of racism, so I'm poorly informed about many things. So, yeah, it's just some books are more enjoyable to read than others. But, yeah, I still learning a lot in reading this text as well. With that, we did our three. We should be back in, I don't know, about 24 hours, 23 hours. We should be back tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific for the compensatory call-in. We'll catch up on news observations from the past 7 days. Again, for listeners, if you have commentary, if you're not able to listen live and you want to email in untiljustice@gmail.com, we can read your commentary on the air. Thanks to everyone tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. I will state again, I know it. Summer is right there. It is warm, beautiful. It was a lovely day here in the Pacific Northwest. Get out and enjoy, but you still want to remain codified. Just because the weather is nice does not mean racists take a break. They do not. And us being intoxicated, evidence shows that does not help to solve this problem. If anything, it makes it 1,000 times worse. It just makes it easier for race soldiers from South Africa to South Carolina to terrorize and abuse black people. And that's race soldiers with or without a badge. Take that very seriously when you go out and really encourage. If you're going to proselytize something, I would say proselytize sobriety and nonviolence in word and deed with other black people. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.